All right, I'll call the meeting to order. And let's start with the roll call. If you're here, please check in on the computer. By the way, under the proclamations, under the first one, we're going to do that one on a roll call to see if our voting system is fixed at this point. We think it is. Bill Feehan and Ralph Geary, we're waiting for you to check in. Have you done that? All right. We have 30 members here. That's a quorum. Let's stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, communications and announcements on the agenda. we have the chair's report. First thing is WCA conference registration. If you are interested in going, it is September, and we're assuming that people are going to want to go for a couple overnights, which would be September 26th to 28th with two overnights in between there. Important date, please write this down. Please remember this because it's going to cost you money if you don't. How's that? The late registration kicks in after July 16th. If you want to go to the WCA conference in September, you need to let Margaret in the chair's office know before July 16th. After July 16th, we will register you, but you will pay the difference, all right? So consider yourself warned. We want as many people to go as possible, but we need you to sign up as soon as we possibly can so that we don't have to worry about that late registration. Also, when we send them all in together, we get a discount too. So everybody should do this through Margaret. Let her coordinate all this and send them in at the same time, because that can also save us money, and she'll take care of hotel reservations and everything else. So again, we're talking about next week is the deadline for sending those in. So please talk to Margaret before then. All right, supervisor conference reports, and as part of that, on your desk, the Interstate Fair. Certainly encourage people to attend that. That's July 14th to 18th. It is traditionally the hottest week of the year, and I suspect probably will be again this year. But it's a good time. I certainly hope people go out there and support our local activities there. Are there any other supervisor conference reports? Anything anybody has? Mr. Bina.
I was just going to make a pitch on the fair myself, but you did a pretty good job of it. The workers are out at the fairgrounds tonight. They're assembling the pens for the goats and the sheep and everything. The fair is all cleaned up. It's ready to go. We had a meeting out there last night. The cattle and animals are coming in on Tuesday. The fair starts on Wednesday. So it's open to anyone. There's absolutely no fee to park, and there's no fee to enter the grounds. So if you want to take the family out to have a good time at the fair, I'd suggest you do, because last night they counted the number of entries we had from people throughout the area that are going to participate in the fair, and there were 12,000 entries listed as of last night. So it goes from animals to pictures to 4-H stuff, gardening stuff. So if you're young at heart, you can buy a $15 ticket, and you can ride on the rides all day long, too. So that's the good deal.
And unlike Riverfest, that costs you $5 to even go up by the river, the Interstate Fair is completely free. All right. Any other reports? Marine Friedland. What's that? Oh, the races, you do have to pay, but that's worth it, too. Marine Friedland.
Okay. The county was a sponsor of a workshop put on by the Greater La Crosse Diversity Council, which we're an active part of, about building inclusive workplaces with positive attitudes towards employees with disabilities. As we all know, La Crosse County employs persons with a range of disabilities. We ensure equal access to county programming and facilities, and we support inclusion in all that we do. Attending the conference were human resource professionals, including our HR director, business owners and operators, and nonprofits and agency directors. And I also wanted to add that there was a panel comprised of employees with disabilities, including one of our own county employees as a presenter. And he stated that his experience has been that the county has been exceptional in accommodating him and his work dog, and that he hoped that he had been teaching a lot as well. He stressed that he was interested in how he can work better with his coworkers, some of whom have hidden as well as apparent disabilities, and how they can all be most productive for the benefit of our county, our clients, and the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. Any other reports? Okay, I have one last announcement here, and I need people to raise their hands, okay? We need two supervisors to be part of the website development team. Remember I mentioned that we're trying to update our website. I mentioned that twice now, and that we were looking for volunteers, and people must have forgotten because nobody's come to talk to me yet. So who are our volunteers? And we're not going home until I get some volunteers here. So who would like to work with our IT department to assist in that regard? Yeah, Brad Conkle. That'll teach him to miss a meeting. You know, it's on a flexible schedule. It'd be working around when people are available. Okay, Tina's got her hand up. Ray, are you volunteering too, or were you just trying to segue into Tina?
After August?
Okay, we'll make a note of that. Okay, so Tina, you're available now. Ray, after August. Okay. Anybody else? Bridget?
Do you have to have any special talent in this area?
If you're on the board, you have talent.
Oh.
So, yes, you qualify. All right, great. We got our volunteers. If anybody else is interested, by the way, we do take latecomers, so just let us know. All right, we have the Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission annual report. Greg Flagstead is here for that.
Did anyone get a copy of the annual report? I got extras here if you didn't. Anyone need a copy? Okay. Okay. First of all, I'd like to start out with saying that everything that I'm going to talk about in this annual report would not have been possible without for La Crosse County and the other eight counties that make up the Regional Planning Commission. You are the Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission. You're one-ninth of the total membership. There's nine counties, and each county appoints three commissioners. Vicki Burke, Jim Mersham, and Tara Johnson are existing commissioners that set policy and programs that we're going to undertake. I'm going to quickly go through the report, and if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them at the end. First of all, you'll see on the first page, the first three articles deal with some of the grants we've written in the past year. None of those, unfortunately, were in La Crosse County. The one was in Gaze Mills for land acquisition. One was for road, water, and sewer to serve Organic Valley in Vernon County. And one was for housing and infrastructure repairs for stormwater and sewer damage and creek stabilization that occurred last August up in Pepin County. Closer to home here, one of the things that we're involved with in our region here is something called industry cluster-based economic development. And what it involves is getting similar companies to meet and get together. We kind of serve as conveners. Our organization, the Technical College, and Workforce Connections to try to get businesses that we call regional economic development drivers for the region. And there's the two big ones are obviously agriculture and food processing, and the other one is equipment and metal manufacturing. As far as the agriculture and food processing, they've been meeting for about 2 years now, and they're really starting to get going. They have their own website set up called frannetwork.org that you can go to and see some of the things that they're involved with. But some of the companies that you'll recognize here, Quick Trip, City Brewery, Bacalar, Century Foods, Organic Valley, Westby Creamy, Foremost Foods, Foremost Farms, Golden Plump, Main Street Ingredients, Newpack, La Crosse Milling, have all participated in these meetings. And one of the things they're undertaking right now is a shrink wrap recycling route, where they're going to be setting up a route amongst companies, as opposed to paying to get rid of shrink wrap and landfill it or what have you. They're going to start recycling it, and then from what I understand, it's used for that Drex decking that you see on people's decks or on their homes and things like that. They also were successful in working with Workforce Connections and the Technical College in getting about $63,000 in training grants that they provided training to their various employees, over 800 employees in machine maintenance, lean overview, electrical safety, OSHA training, food safety, ammonia awareness, and things like that. And the role the Regional Planning Commission played in this is that we were the original organizers trying to get this concept going, because of some of the economic development literature we've been reading, that what makes regions and communities successful is trying to develop a export economy, and the way you do that is finding out where your key economic driver industries are and getting them together, having them meet, convene, talk about their resources they have among each other, and excess capacities and things that they can work together relating to joint ventures and things like that. Another association that was set up back in 2007 that we serve as a liaison for is the Equipment and Metal Manufacturing Association, and they too have been quite successful recently. Some of the things that they were able to get a grant again through the Workforce Connections and the Technical College to do some training for their employees in their industry. But some of the companies, again, that have been involved with this cluster, River Steel, Mid-City Steel, PayCal, S&S Cycle, 3M Don Prairie Sheen, Matthews and Sparta, L.B. White and Onalaska, USEMCO and Toman, Nisita Screw and Machine, Nisita, Mississippi Welder Supply, D&S Manufacturing, are just some of the companies that have been involved with this. And again, they're working together to help themselves become more globally competitive, so to speak, the term you're hearing nowadays. One more thing I'll touch on relating to the Equipment and Metal Manufacturing Association is that one neat thing that happened was through these meetings that these companies have more awareness of each other's capacities. Mid-City Steel was able to bid on a project that they normally would not have been able to bid because they heard of USEMCO's metal rolling capacity that they could use and then bid on a project that they usually would not have been able to bid on. And also USEMCO, at one time they're thinking about laying off some welders, and they heard through these meetings and acquaintances through these meetings that D&S up in Black River Falls got a major contract, I think it was with Oshkosh Truck, and they were able to actually move some of their welders for a time being to work up at D&S in Black River Falls. The next couple pages of the annual report deal with comprehensive plans. We were involved with 10 of them in the last year. Two of them were in La Crosse County. On page 4, town of Farmington, we were involved in helping prepare that comprehensive plan, and the town of Greenfield as well. From what I understand, these plans will become part of your county comprehensive plan in the near future. Incorporated as an amendment. We've also prepared some recreation plans and updates for various counties and communities, and what these plans do is help these communities become more competitive when they apply for land and water conservation grants or Wisconsin stewardship funds. Things like trails, handicapped fishing piers, boat ramps, ADA renovations to restrooms and showers, campgrounds, things like that are often projects that are applied for as a result of this planning, and where communities become more competitive to be able to get the grants for these facilities. We also have updated several county hazard mitigation plans where we identify the various risks and projects to reduce the risks to these vulnerabilities that counties are vulnerable to or communities are vulnerable to, whether it's flooding, tornadoes, wind, things like that. And again, as a result of preparing these hazard mitigation plans, the county can apply to FEMA for mitigation grants even when there's not a natural disaster. We also are involved with revolving loan funds throughout the region. I counted them the other day. There's over 20 revolving loan funds in the 9 counties that we serve. We've provided service to a lot of these. The 3 big ones are the Business Capital Fund, the CMV Growth Fund, standing for Crawford, Monroe, and Vernon County Fund, and then the La Crosse County Revolving Loan Fund we've provided services to, and our services vary with these revolving loan funds from doing everything from doing the initial loan write-up and preparing the loan closing documents to just answering some phone calls and helping some communities out with their revolving loan fund. Also, La Crosse County, being part of the Regional Planning Commission, is part of what's also called the Economic Development District, designated by the U.S. Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration. And this makes you eligible for funding year in and year out to the Economic Development Administration for public works projects, technical assistance grants, research grants, things like that, not only the county and communities, but the universities, what have you, can apply to EDA as well because of this designation. In the past, some of the grants that have come to La Crosse County through this designation has been La Crosse Center and La Crosse Center Ramp, the Lakeview Business Park, and a few years ago, City Brewery got it. Assistance when they're having some problems as to who the next ownership was going to be. The city got them a grant from EDA to do some engineering work regarding their buildings and what new technologies might work best in that building. You'll also see on the page 7 there that we are audited. There's a brief profile there of what the Regional Planning Commission is all about. And under acknowledgments, I'd like to point out again that none of this would have been possible without the support of the county boards of the 9 counties, and it's the combined resources of La Crosse County and the other counties and the federal state agencies that make the Regional Planning Commission work. So that, in a nutshell, is an annual report.
Anybody have any questions for Greg? Mr. Bina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of curious. You work with a lot of municipalities and nonprofit organizations. I sit on the fair board here from West Salem. Mm-hmm. Our electrical wiring out there is getting awful old, and we're thinking about redoing it. Would that be we have 5 lines internally feeding the system, and we want to go to probably 1, but is that something we could have you work at, or isn't it? Or who should we go to maybe the new energy department in the state would probably be the place.
Yeah. I'm thinking like Focus on Energy or
Focus on Energy,
something
yeah.
like that. Or that's through Xcel in West Salem, I assume?
Is it what?
Through Xcel Energy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Focus on Energy would be the route to go for.
But that wouldn't be a project you'd get involved in then.
We could look into it. I mean, as far as what your options might be, you know, as far
okay,
as
I may, I may call you later okay. and talk about it some at a little more length.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Right, Greg, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. All right, next up we have the administrator's report where we have 2 proclamations and a agenda item that you're going to see pretty much every meeting from now until November, and that is the 2011 budget update. And I would remind people we're always looking, and I can say this every time too, we're always looking for suggestions that you have for the budget. If you wait till the last minute and propose something at the November meeting, there's not going to be enough time to research it. So any ideas that you have, certainly get in touch with our county administrator or Gary Engelson, our finance director. Let's get the proclamation, Mr. O'Malley.
Proclamation, July 2010, Nursing Home Month. Whereas La Crosse County residents or members of their family are provided affordable quality nursing care services in a family-like environment, including those who care may be difficult or those without financial support, and whereas staff is committed to excellence in providing care and rehabilitation to all with respect for the dignity and rights of individuals, including those who have special physical, developmental, and mental health needs, and whereas La Crosse County operates two nursing homes, Hillview Health Care Center and Lakeview Health Center, now therefore be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of July as La Crosse County Nursing Home Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to ensuring quality care and art to our residents in need.
Moved by Mr. Brockmiller, seconded by Monica Cruz. Discussion? Can you do this on the computer? Cross your fingers, hope it works. Bridget, did you vote? Audrey Cotter, did you vote?
Yep.
Oh, Bob Kyle. That passed on a vote of 31-0, and the computer worked. So great. Next one.
Proclamation, July 26, 2010, 20th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Whereas La Crosse County openly embraces individuals with disabilities, and whereas La Crosse County will remain committed in the efforts to fully implement Americans with Disability Act, and whereas La Crosse County recognizes the progress that has been made by reaffirming the principles of quality inclusion to reach full ADA compliance, now therefore be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the 26th day of July in the year 2010 as the 20th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act and urges all citizens to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of this act and continue the commitment to work towards full ADA compliance.
Moved by Terry Johnson, seconded by Jill Billings. Discussion? Maureen Friedland.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that this proclamation was requested by an employee in the Aging and Disability Resource Center, someone who has a disability as well as a whole lot of abilities. And it's part of a nationwide effort to get 2010 city and county governments to issue a similar proclamation to recognize us. And this employee said when he was asking for this proclamation, he wanted to point out that the ADA has changed the lives of people with disabilities, including those who have come in contact with the county. So thank you for getting this to us.
Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Budget.
Okay, this is, as Steve mentioned, as the chairman mentioned, an ongoing series that we're going to continue to bring you information and bring you up to date. Ginny, if you could bring up the slide. Apologize I didn't get all this information into your packet. Some of it's good reading material you want to take with, but it's important to keep you up to date as the full board, not just individual committees, on what's happening with budget preparation. And some of this is a little repetitious from what I talked about with the Human Services Board last night in the executive committee. We consolidated a little bit of information. Obviously, the budget challenges continue to remain following the lowest increase we've had in 11 years. We continue to need to respond to the issue of a debt payment increasing next year. We're going to talk more about that as we go ahead. Increased service demands and very difficult impacts on smaller departments. Residential care in mental health and family and children will continue to be highly volatile. Lakeview and highway operating and maintenance and capital needs will continue to challenge us. And of course, as we've talked about, interest revenue and sales tax revenue are all down. In addition to that, as we deal with wage and benefit issues, even going into the new year, though we don't have a 2011 settlement, you have residual impacts from the cost of the wage settlements and benefit settlements this year. Everything from people changing whether they take single or family health insurance to impacts effects of a 2-1 split that was the actual settlement for this year that actually pushes a 0.5% of that cost into 2011. So we're analyzing those impacts, but it does end up building on the challenges for next year's budget. County Administrator's budget is due to you in September. We've already started the process and have met with many of our departments. Given the major challenges and the scheduled increase for the next LEC debt payment, my direction to departments has been to bring to me a budget recommendation that was within their existing operating levy or less. That has to be across the board. We already have the issue of dealing with the debt payment. It's going to make our budget choices very challenging. But to meet these challenges, we're going to have to work very closely with our employee groups. We've already held a series of meetings with management employees, with department heads, and with bargaining unit groups. We have one left to go where we're seeking employee input and suggestions in a more formal way than just asking for an employee suggestion box, but engaging employees around issues of budget savings that are not directly related to bargaining. We want to make sure that they understand some of the challenges that we have, but we also engage their creativity in how we meet the challenges before us and bring you the best information we can in making budget choices. Just this afternoon, we met with the executive committee and talked about our bargaining strategy related to bargaining. Remember, you're not going to be in a position of being able to have wage settlements and benefit settlements similar to previous years. When we established our previous pattern, it was in 2007 when it was a different economic situation. We ended up having 3 years' worth of a pattern of settlements. That was then, this is now. We're in a much more challenging position. That's a message that we've been bringing to our employee groups, and obviously the public knows, and that's something we're going to need to bring back through the bargaining process, and we'll be discussing as ongoing budget cycle comes up. The first step will be to actually reverse the order that that we do some things. Generally, what we've done is we've brought you a non-union resolution for the following year after we have labor settlements with our bargaining units. I believe that it's our responsibility as non-union to bring you a very frugal non-union compensation resolution for 2011, setting the stage for our discussions with the bargaining units. Recognize that that's not considered a comparable under binding arbitration. Non-union settlements are not considered comparable, but I think we need to set the stage and the tone for our discussions with our bargaining units. We're all in this together, and we really have a great labor management relationship with our bargaining units. We need to strive to continue to, that, but we need to continue the ongoing dialogue of meeting the challenges of the rate limit, the levy limit, and, of course, the budget challenges that that we're learning about daily. Just this afternoon, in preparation for this, I received a Wheeler report that ends up keeping us up to date on all of the issues that are going on. Governor Doyle has already instructed departments to begin their preparation of their 2011-2013 budget, preparing for an across-the-board 10% reductions in virtually every area except for entitlement or related assistance in Department of Health and Human Services and also in areas of corrections. We aren't yet to the bottom of exactly what that impact will be, but it will be our responsibility to discuss what the contingencies are to deal with that, how much of that may impact us in the 2011 budget or most likely in the 2012 budget. But you can see that even though Governor Doyle won't be in that position for next year, he's already had to start on behalf of the state the budget preparation process and the kinds of projections that will impact our ability to provide services as well as the ability of the state to provide adequate funding. We are meeting later on this month with our health insurance consultants, and we'll look at every option that we have dealing with future costs of health insurance. We'll be discussing that more in the budget cycle as well as with bargaining units. And finally, departments have begun to do their detailed preparation of budgets. They're due to Finance and Administration later this month, and though you won't receive the administrator's budget recommendation until September, each agenda item, particularly for policy planning, will contain some very significant issues related to budget, related to budget decisions. Stay tuned with that. The August 9th planning meeting will include our comprehensive annual financial report and report from our auditor. So that's really the year-end close and what our financial position is in relation to going ahead. We'll also receive recognition of our Government Finance Officers Award for excellence in preparation of financial statements, our fifth year in a row, I believe, Gary, and very proud of that. It demonstrates the quality of staff that we have in our finance department and throughout our organization preparing financial information to give you and your administrator the best information possible to make decisions. We'll also do a primer on binding arbitration. Supervisor Geary asked that we do that, especially with new board members, to prepare you for some of the choices and options that we have. That will be an open session, but it's as much to educate you and update you on the options that bargaining units have and employers have in relation to the meat arb law, or binding arbitration. Finally, we'll have a number of budget topics that will be on that night, perhaps indirect costs. We promise to bring that information back to you. If we're able to prepare it for that night, we'll do some. Supervisor Ebert has asked about that. So we'll continue to bring you information that as you identify issues, there were a couple identified last night at Health and Human Services. We take notes throughout each of these discussions. So we'll bring you back information and data that you've asked for that will help you in the decision-making process. As I get into that, and I realized I jumped right into the presentation, but I don't want to forget this. I really want to thank the board and department heads and employee groups, because next week I'm going to be gone. I'm actually going to be on my 13th annual Habitat for Humanity 500-mile bike ride. Many of you know that in addition to being the administrator, I try to find ways to give back to community and try to serve as well. And as I said, current board members, retired board members, department heads, retired department heads, existing employees and retired employees, Rotary members, and other community members have contributed to get rid of me for a week, but also to raise money for Habitat. And so far this year, I will have been a catalyst to raise over $11,000 for Twin Cities Habitat, almost $900 for Rice County Habitat, and over $5,000 for La Crosse County Habitat. And so I'm just pleased to get so much support from so many of you. If you have not yet contributed and we're still thinking about it, please do so. So that was a brief commercial. But seriously, I'm just happy to get away for a little bit of time and do some good work. We've had some impact in this community and built a number of Habitat homes. We've even had a volunteer group where we had Jim and Charlie and Jeff and a number of us were actually on site helping build a home in Holman. So just another way that we try to provide service to the community. So that wasn't the right timing. I wanted to do that before I started budget update, but I almost forgot. So in essence, and in summary, the budget challenges continue to be there, but as you can see, we're not sitting on our hands and complaining about everything from the rate limit to the levy limit. There's time for impacting those kinds of things, but we still have to deal with the challenges ahead, and we really have to position ourselves to respond to the next 2 or 3 years, and that's the strategy we're taking, particularly the direction to our department heads. The other information, and there's a pretty detailed information packet that I've provided, and if you refer to the memo that actually has all of the attached detailed data, each time that I provide you information on comparisons with other counties in the state, most of the time, historically, I've just provided you with the graphs, but I wanted to respond to a number of the questions that were raised over the last couple of presentations and to give you information and the actual background detail, not just graphs, but you can do your own research and verify information that's here. But it was suggested that we have a low ranking like Eau Claire because both have lower household incomes and may receive more federal and state aid than other counties. So I went online, and the most recent comparative study that was done by the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance was actually in 2005. And if you look at the attached table to the memo, it's summarized in the graphic that's before you. La Crosse County actually receives less per capita in state aid and slightly less than federal aid than the average. Eau Claire actually receives more in state aid and about the same in federal aid per capita than we do. Again, this is independent. It's not our analysis. It's actually done by Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. They'll probably they update this generally every 5 years, but it indicates that on a per capita basis and a revenue basis, our low spending, our low tax levy is not related to receiving a lot more in state aid. It's based on the history of decisions that we've made here. Another statement was made that sales tax revenue is often forgotten, and I want to indicate that we never forget about or don't appreciate the fact that we have another revenue source other than property taxes, which is the sales tax revenue. But I wanted to make sure that while on a dollar-for-dollar comparison, we are the fifth lowest per capita, even when you account for the sales tax revenue, if we had to levy back for that entire amount of sales tax and would have the same level of spending, it would be an impact to our taxes. It would raise property taxes by 30% for the county portion. And yet, we would still be ninth in the state out of all counties. And I provided you with both the data that shows you the original information, as well as if all counties levied the sales tax. There are only 10 counties that don't levy the sales tax, most of them on the west, the eastern side of the state. But if you notice, our ranking compared to other counties doesn't change that drastic, and in fact, our ranking compared to the other counties of similar size stays the same, even if we were not to have the sales tax. It does help us lower the cost of county operations to the property taxpayer and is a vital part of our ability to control property taxes, but we are still one of the lowest ranking counties, even if you were to account take that into account. It seems to me that the concern seems to be that sales tax may enable a higher level of expenditures than property taxes, that if we didn't have the property tax being seemingly easier to collect than property taxes, that we might actually even spend less. And again, referring to WTA, the most recent study that they've done in 2005 along with revenues was to compare expenditures, and according to the 2005 analysis, La Crosse County was the third lowest in total expenditures per capita. And I think that, again, continues to indicate the type of culture, the type of creativity, and the hard work this organization has had for a long time, preceding my administration, but also hopefully continuing during the time that I've been your administrator. And you end up seeing the graphic there, as well as the detail sheet that's included in your table. We've also talked about how we compare with other counties of similar size, and this is not adjusted per capita. This is actual dollar amounts each year of property tax levy. And we notice that if you combine all of that information in each of the last 5 years since the analysis that was done by WTA, we continue to be the lowest, except for Eau Claire, and I'm going to touch on that in a moment, and only Sheboygan County out of all of our comparables does not use the sales tax now. Every other one uses the sales tax that is also included in your data, so you've got that information. Fond du Lac just added the sales tax this year. They use part of it for their budget. They're doing part of it for economic development because of, I think it's Mercury Marine, I think, is the employer that they've chosen to use a portion of that for. So this shows, again, that we continue to be, compared to counties of comparable size, in absolute dollar amount, spending less in property tax levy. And again, the per capita expenditure data is included in that. But let me talk about, because it's come up in public hearings before in our budget and other folks that have talked to us, that perhaps we should be emulating Eau Claire. And Eau Claire obviously has a warm spot in my heart. For those of you that don't know, I started out as a county board member on the Eau Claire County Board at the age of 19 and served for three different terms there. So I know a little bit about Eau Claire and Eau Claire's budget, and I went online and actually looked at this. There's a detailed sheet that actually does some of that comparison. And what I ended up learning was that we have not had an apples-to-apples comparison with Eau Claire County, because I had forgotten that Eau Claire County's budget does not actually levy for their library. The Ellie Phillips Library is actually a separate taxing jurisdiction that's completely independent of the Eau Claire County levy and the City of Eau Claire levy, whereas, as you know, your library budget is included in your budget. If you do an apples-to-apples comparison, and the detailed data is here, and take out the county library as part of our budget, we actually have a lower per capita levy than Eau Claire on an apples-to-apples comparison because they are not having to pay for that within their budget. That would move us to fourth per capita compared to all counties, seventh if all counties use the sales tax, and eighth if no counties use the sales tax. It ends up reflecting that through all of that. In addition, you might be interested in knowing that a lot of times we do comparisons with Eau Claire because they're so similar in size. We're about 14% larger population. Our levy is a little bit less than theirs. They've actually had to rely a lot more on the use of their fund balance and are very, very stark in their ability to rely on fund balance to end up dealing with unforeseen circumstances. Again, according to their budget document that is a public document available on their website, they're down to just under 7% unreserved and undesignated fund balance. They roll all of their other funds into the general fund. They don't have separate reserves in other parts of their budget. And we follow county board policy established some years ago at 41% of general fund expenditures plus other reserves in other funds. So we're more easily able to not have to overreact but respond to challenges and impacts within volatile areas. Other major differences that are actually a good deal for our community, and I think it's important for you as board members and for us to remember that we provide a great value for our community. One example is we provide consolidated dispatch communication center to our entire community without charging back to the cities or the municipalities. In Eau Claire, for example, they just provide a payment to the city who operates dispatch, and the city then has to levy a tax in addition to that. So the fact that we provide a $2 million value to our community without chargeback, and it's provided for at a countywide level, is another way that we're providing value to our communities and to our largest city that doesn't have to provide a levy for that service, unlike the city of Eau Claire. However, the county of Eau Claire ends up against my vote, ended up operating an airport actually owned in Chippewa County. I never understood why they ended up doing that. We don't provide much support to our airport, but we do have a nursing home that ends up, again, costing us some additional levy money. We think we provide a good regional service and meeting a need, while the nursing home, there is no nursing home levy in Eau Claire. Three other differences that I'd like to point out just to show you some of the challenges that even Eau Claire has had to try to maintain low property taxes. They do short-term borrowing far more than we do in highway, over $3.1 million a year for highway. You know that last year we made the decision to do $1.6 million of short-term borrowing for highways. They also borrow for capital projects of $874,000. We don't do capital borrowing for projects at this point, and we're hoping to not have to do that. We're trying to maintain our short-term debt strategies. Their long-term debt levy is actually larger than ours for their law enforcement center because they're having to build brand new. They're actually building all at once. I think it's a $50 or $60 million project. Don't quote me on that number, but I know that they finally decided to go ahead, and they've actually built that within their budget. As you know, one of our challenges is paying the first LEC off as we're adding to the next one, but you'll see our number climbing, of course, with this next increase. I just wanted to give you some information because I think we have a record to be very proud of. We've done a great deal to try to control our levy, to control our expenditures for our community, and provide the best value. That doesn't mean that our job is going to be any easier now. It's actually going to be tougher. That doesn't mean that gives us carte blanche to say, well, I guess we've done our part. We just have to lobby for more levy authority, or we have to make more changes. We need to roll up our sleeves and do the best we can for the benefit of our taxpayers to hold the line, and that's the direction that we'll be providing in the budget over the months to come. The last item I thought that would be very interesting was, I think one of the larger questions as we talk about the sales tax is really, as policymakers, is the 0.5% sales tax good for La Crosse County taxpayers? And so I wanted to provide the information. There's a detailed chart of a per capita, and you'll recognize if you look at this that La Crosse County actually generates in revenue the seventh highest per capita in sales tax revenue in the state out of all 72 counties. And if you look at the counties of of similar size and those that generate a lot, you end up seeing a lot of names in there that kind of jump out at you. Well, why would they generate a lot of sales tax revenue? They're regional centers. They attract people from other areas for shopping, for tourism. You look at some of the largest generators, Dane County, Brown County, Door County, La Crosse County. We are in a position as a regional center to capture some of those sales tax revenue to help control property taxes in a way that other counties don't have that same experience. If you look at our surrounding areas of counties just adjacent to us, you will see that their per capita generation of sales tax is not on the scale and is far below the state average that is to the left of ours. This is a good deal, I think, for our community because it allows us to capture the fact that we are a regional center, we are a regional destination and an attraction, and we're able to capture some of those revenues to end up helping reduce. That doesn't explain the whole reason that we're one of the lowest, but it does explain part of it, the difference between 5th and 9th, if you look at that kind of comparison. And then just last but not least, I know it's a little bit small in your presentation, and it was the best graphic I was able to put together in a couple of minutes. You notice that the 10 Wisconsin counties that don't have the sales tax are over on the eastern side of the state. There are various political considerations for why some of them have done it and not that I won't wade into, but you'll notice that it is very rare in the state out of 72 counties to not have relied on the 0.5% sales tax. And because we're a regional center, we get a larger amount of revenue that helps us keep things off the property taxes within relation to the services we provide. Because sales tax is less regressive than property tax, in my opinion, property tax is not tied into somebody's income or ability to pay. Sales tax is, and I think it's a very positive information. So I've tried to give you a whole lot of information because of a number of the questions that were raised. I hope you go away with the detailed data that now you have, rather than just some graphs and charts. If you have questions now, I can try to answer them, or if in the future you have questions, I want to make sure that we're giving you information in response to your questions.
Questions or comments for Steve? John Menninger.
Yeah, interesting presentation. The question I had is on this federal money. You said $3 per capita. It just doesn't seem right. We got a $133 million budget. We levy $29 million in property taxes. $3 is like $400,000. We got like a $2 million obesity grant. It's got to be way higher.
It may be. This is the 2005 analysis done by WTA. I'll get more into the detail of the methodology. I know they try to do accounting for example, part of our $133 million budget would be solid waste. That wouldn't fit here in state or federal aid. But I'll get more into the details of the methodology. Again, this is their data, just sorted by their information. But, yes,
same
kind of
questions.
I'm sure
they can figure out the $3, but I just think of federal aids, you know, in all kinds of ways. I mean, maybe we don't count general aid like medical assistance or
Well, if I may add, there's a significant amount of federal revenue that comes through the state. It's actually acknowledged as being state revenue at that point.
Right. Just like if you look at the number that talks about total taxes, that's not our property tax, right? That's probably I believe it's sales tax and property tax that's levied per capita in this county.
So, like, for example, I don't know if we get much WETA money. If WETA comes here and gives us a big check for $3 million, but it's a pass-through from the federal money, it's counted as state money because WETA gives you the check.
And because it doesn't go through the county budget, it's not part of this, but it is aid to this community.
Yeah. Okay.
Again, this is to the county budget specifically, and again, done by Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance.
But I would, just because I work for you, Senator Herb Gohl, I guess, but I would just think in that $133 million, there's a lot of federal money, but it's not counted as federal dollars.
Well, as an example, if you notice the one that gets the largest dollar amount of state aid, it's Menominee County. As a small county and a tribe, everything may go through that entity as opposed to a city or a nonprofit or something else. But if Senator Cole wanted to provide more aid, I'm sure we'd be pleased to accept it.
Actually, for Don Bina here, we've been asked, Senator Cole has been asked to find the $50,000 to do the fair's electrical grid system. So.
And that would make Supervisor Bina happy.
So you can report back next month that we got that money, John?
Ha ha ha.
Bill Feehan.
Thank you, Chairman. My question goes to solid waste, and in the Health and Human Services meeting last night, I learned that 8% of our Health and Human Service budget comes from solid waste. So how does the income that we're generating through our solid waste program impact the spending? How much money is that?
Could you back up? Where did you hear that we have 8% of our solid waste budget going to human services?
The presentation that was handed out at the Health and Human Services Board last night said that 70% of the income comes from the feds, 21% from the state, and that 8% is coming from solid waste.
Oh, you're taking it out of context. That is the entire county budget, $133 million, 8%. That's actually, in fact, you didn't pick up the slides from last meeting. That was for the whole county budget, and she used that to show the timeline of the entire state budget. It was in their slide showing the timeline. I can show you that.
Just interested in how that impacts on.
There is no solid waste revenue going to Health and Human Services whatsoever. We couldn't justify that at all. But you ended up looking at the bottom part of a slide talking about the whole county budget and the whole state budget. And you'll see it when, in fact, I've got an extra copy.
You know, you're a clever guy. Why can't you figure out a way for us to get some of that? Well, I don't know if we would. I think the other counties who participate in our program might. Pardon? And the accountants wouldn't like it either. I think we'd have our butts in a lawsuit pretty quick. Does anybody have any questions of Gary or Dave or me in the meantime? Ralph Geary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think John hit the nail on the head. We got a $133 million budget. If we're only levying $26 million with our levy and our sales tax, we got over $100 million unaccounted for. That's about $1,000 per person. On this handout, it's saying we're getting $300 approximately in federal and state aid. I'm sure that applies to all the counties because they must have did it all the same way, but somewhere out there, is a lot of money that's unaccounted for.
I want to correct you. The money is never unaccounted for. That's why you have a comprehensive annual financial report.
It's just we don't know where it is.
No, we know exactly where it is, and we'll keep responding to this discussion. But the assertion was made, Supervisor Geary, that somehow the reason that we end up being lower is because we get a lot more federal or state aid. So I thought I'd go do some research to actually see what do other people, not the county administrator say, not the finance department, but what does an independent agency like Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance say about how we compare on state and federal aid? No, a significant portion of our budget, 8%, is from solid waste. That's not state or federal aid. That's a charge to the users of that service. We also have licenses. We have fees. And we'll get into all of that in the entire discussion of the budget. But I rest assured, no money is unaccounted for. That's why you have a comprehensive financial statement.
It's still a fact that we're getting more than $300 per person in state and federal aid, or $3 from the federal, but if you had the state and the federal, and if you looked at our budget, it's much higher than that. But I'm not going to beat it to death. No. How did I get that idea that we got a little more aid from the federal? Because I had asked Jerry Huber about it, and he said on a couple programs, they take average income into an account, and if you lower the income, the more money you gave. He's not here to defend himself, so I don't want to beat that one to death. But I got a real good piece of information coming in that you don't need to generate. Mr. Brockmiller, I've been hounding him for 6 months to give us the average income levels of all these counties. If we're at the bottom, I assume we should be paying less taxes than the ones that are earning much higher because they have a better ability to pay. But you don't have to do that one. Mr. Brockmiller is going to do that.
Actually, it's in your Mississippi Regional Planning Report. Yeah, but it doesn't have all the counties, but it's the ones that are nearby. So we'll save you a little bit of work. But it's included in the handout that Greg
just passed. I've been holding him for long. I want him to finish it.
Okay. Stay tuned. We'll get that report from Mr. Brockmiller.
Okay.
Next on the list, I have Jerry Sobranek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just looking at this graph here, and I'm just curious and wondering, is there any significance why all these non-tax counties are clustered in this part of the eastern part of the state? Do you have any opinion or theory or anything reasoning on that?
I think it's the politics of the decision of whether or not to levy a new tax. When the sales tax was offered as an option for counties back in what it was 91, I think. It was 89, I think, because I was administrator of Marinette County. It was a significant debate whether or not to levy that. And I think a number of counties have just balked at the idea of increasing a tax, regardless of where it comes from and how it would be utilized.
Ray Ebert.
I was kind of curious because if it had something to do with being a metropolitan area, just wondering why it was all on the eastern side of the state and clustered. Just curious about that.
I know when we talked about ours, one of the concerns was, gee, if we're the first one in this area and the counties around us don't have it, are people going to, you know, go shop in Sparta or whatever the case may be? So if you look at them all clustered, you know, if somebody says in Calumet County or Brown County, let's do it, are they going to be concerned then that all the shoppers are going to get sent to those counties around? So you may have some of that dynamic going on there too. Now Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I noticed you said the executive committee met and considering bargaining strategy. Will we be briefed before rather than just get a settlement dumped in our laps?
Oh, yeah.
Because we weren't last
as
time.
That's going to be part of the budget process.
But just recognize that the executive committee is our, quotes, personnel committee that gives us guidance on, just like budget gives us guidance on bargaining.
Absolutely. I just think that we should also know what that strategy is during, not after, would be my request. Thank you.
Right.
Sure. In addition, without getting into and bargaining through the newspaper, if you can read between the lines the type of restrictions we have in the budget, you have a pretty clear idea that business as usual can't continue.
I don't want to read between the lines. I want to hear it, what it is, not have to go and read between the lines. Thank you.
Any further questions or comments, Chair Johnson?
I would just remind all county board supervisors that attendance at all committee meetings, including closed session, is open to all county board supervisors.
Good point. Good point. Certainly encourage people to attend, especially the executive committee meetings over the next few months. They're going to be very interesting. Jill Billings.
I would also like to mention that concern was raised at the exec committee. Excuse me. And by Supervisor Spiker, that everyone received that information well in advance of the in the budget process, so that everybody understands what's going on.
Bill Brockmiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, I assume, but I don't know, so I'd like to, that our bond rating must be much better than Eau Claire's as well, isn't it, with the way they're...
You know, it's surprising that it hasn't affected their bond rating. They're still at AA2. There's some question of what's going to happen overall with bond ratings by Moody's. They're talking about restructuring the entire system. But no, Eau Claire, along with many of our comparables, are in the AA2 rating. So it's not just about fund balances. It's about a whole lot of economic issues. Yeah. But they have the same as ours.
Okay.
We have some second-timers, but are there any first-timers that have not had a chance to ask a question or make a comment yet? Okay, then Bill Feehan.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my question is, when we talk about the revenue, the spending in La Crosse County, and we see that 8% of our $133 million budget is funded out of solid waste, that's about, well, it's over $10 million a year. So, you know, how does that compare? I mean, I know we have the highest tipping fee in the state at $68 a ton, and that the average for a county is $44. And of course, we have that contract with Xcel where we're selling them our garbage. So that seems to be quite a significant generator of revenue for the county. How does that impact our comparison to other counties?
It doesn't, because the comparison that we're doing is on levy, not on growth, on the total budget. And the tipping fee goes to the solid waste department. It doesn't go to human services, doesn't go to highway, doesn't go to other purposes. It's tied into solid waste operations. and the comparisons that I've done are on tax levy, what goes against local property taxpayers. You don't pay for your garbage service through your county taxes. You pay for it through either your city taxes, or in some communities, you pay it as a user fee, but not through the county.
Well, yeah, but whatever company is contracted to pick up our garbage has got to dump at the county landfill, or at least that's probably what we're hoping. So in the end, the tipping fees do impact the cost of garbage collection.
Oh, of course. I'm just trying to clarify for you that the comparisons I was doing is on property tax levy. Every county does it differently on garbage. So, for example, Eau Claire no longer has a landfill. They sold it out. They're completely out of the business. They're completely subject to whatever the market tells them will end up happening, and they fill up the landfill as fast. They used to have that as an asset. They used to own that. They decided to completely privatize that. We've made a different decision in this community. The policymakers of this body, of this county, have made a different decision than Eau Claire. So you wouldn't even see that in their budget. Their $90 million budget doesn't include anything directly for solid waste because they liquidated their landfill. They sold it.
So the $10 million that is raised through solid waste disposal, that is spent exclusively in solid waste? I mean, at the last meeting we talked about 19,400 coming out of the sustainability budget and tipping fees. So what you're telling me is that that $10 million is exclusively funding solid waste?
Solid waste operations, and yes, there's a small portion of their budget on sustainability. We added a position, what was it, 3 years ago now? Nick Nichols, who is our sustainability coordinator, that works in that area. So that's the one small area that is related to solid waste, related to sustainability, related to recycling and providing services. But that revenue doesn't go beyond that budget.
So I know I'm getting ahead of us a little bit here with the projected gas project with Gunderson. But is that a profit-generating endeavor for the county, and how does that impact spending and taxes?
We're going to keep you in suspense on that one, and you will find that answer out in just a few minutes.
Yes, that's a good segue to our next presentation.
Well, John Mettinger has his hand up, and then we'll go to
that. Yeah, and I think this everybody here understands it, but you know, we're the county board, so we compare ourselves to 71 other counties, and even when you take a look at things like per capita income, La Crosse County doesn't come out too bad statewide when you talk about average per capita income, but when you start taking a look at the individual municipalities within the county, there's tremendous differences, and that's because the city of La Crosse has got the second highest poverty rate in the state, but we're not the second poorest county in the state because we're surrounded by fairly wealthy subdivisions and suburbs. I mean, La Crosse County, I think it's somewhere around $30,000 per capita average income. Town of Shelby's over $70,000 per capita. So if you average those two together, you come out pretty good. So when you start comparing counties and say, well, we're the 34th wealthiest county in the state, you have to drill down a little bit to get where the disparities within that county. And certainly that's one of the reasons the city of La Crosse might get a lot more money, because it's based upon poverty indicators. The county may not get so much because we're not as poor when you do the whole county-wide average. And we're getting poor.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, that gets us up to the next topic.
Have we got the next slide presentation up? I think I have to do it actually the first time.
Okay. This is the solid waste proposal gas to energy project with Gunderson Lutheran.
And Supervisor Feehan, hold that question until later. We're going to get into the impact and the discussion regarding this. Our purpose tonight, and we've got Hank who's going to do parts of this, Gary Engelson, so you're not going to have to listen to me do every slide. I just get to do the intro, so we'll give you a break from hearing my voice for a little while. But the gas to energy project is a very exciting opportunity for our community and for one of our largest community organizations, Gunderson Lutheran. It really is a response to the status that our community has said, both the city and of La Crosse, the city of Onalaska, and La Crosse County have said, we want to be a more sustainable community. We want to look for ways to save energy dollars as well as to be a better utilizer of the resources in our community. And so it really is a way to generate green dollars from a resource that currently is just being flared off, that is just being burned. We're going to do an educational presentation. We're all going to learn with question and answer. Please feel free to stop any of the presenters and ask questions on this. I've been a peripheral part of this, trying to help guide the discussion, but the lion's share of the work has been done by Hank Cook, Nick Nichols, Gary Engelson, and Bill Shepard from Corp Counsel, Dave Lang from Corp Counsel. So it's really been a team effort of legal, finance, solid waste, and sustainability at looking at how we might be able to better capture a resource that we're currently just burning off in a flare. We've been making monthly reports back to Public Works and Infrastructure as the governing committee for the solid waste area and keeping them up to speed on what's been going on. And this agenda item will also be on your agenda tomorrow to see what kind of follow-up and what kind of details you would prefer as we continue to go through this process. So the team approach has really served us well in identifying the finances, identifying the benefits, and trying to give you the wealth of that decision. Rather than having to make a decision tonight, we're trying to bring everybody up to speed on what's being considered, what the impact will be, what the pros and cons will be, so that when we bring something back under the current timeline in August, you're better prepared to actually be asked to make that decision. So I think Hank is going next. I'll turn this over to Hank Cook.
So just checking for landmines as I get up. I didn't find any.
Watch out for grenades.
Actually, I got a smile on my face tonight that a mortician couldn't get off my face. I am so pleased with this gas-to-energy project. I've been involved in a number over 20 years. This is a fantastic project, and you're going to see that tonight. Could I have the next slide, please? On the bottom right here.
But you didn't tell people that's your favorite picture ever.
Almost. I like something with garbage in it, though. What we're going to cover tonight for you is we're going to get you a report on what we've been doing to date with this project. We're going to get some technical information to you, not a lot of detail, but just some technical information so you're comfortable with what this is all about. Gary's going to cover the financial aspects of this project. David's going to talk about the contract aspects of this project, and then we'll have a chance to do some questions. Now, Nick was supposed to do this introduction. He's off on vacation right now, but he was the project manager and still is, and he's been pulling us together, doing the notes, setting the agendas, coordinating the meetings. So I do want, you know, him to share in some of the glory of what's been occurring to date. Why are we here? We're here to answer questions prior to the point where you have to make a decision and where we ask to make a commitment with Gunderson Lutheran to this project, which we're going to ask you in August. Let me give you a little bit of history. How did we get here then? I know La Crosse County's been talking about what to do with their gas for many years. And it was in 2009 that we found some money available through the Focus on Energy grants that we said, let's study the feasibility of a gas-to-energy project for La Crosse County. So that's what we did, and we finished that feasibility study towards the end of 2009. We looked at a lot of different alternatives. We looked at little microturbines that produce electricity that could be located on the site or off. We looked at cleaning up our gas so that it was pipeline quality and putting it into a pipeline so that it could be sold as natural gas. We looked at cleaning up our gas and compressing it and so that it could be used in gas-powered vehicles. There are some landfills in our country where the garbage truck drives in, dumps a load of garbage, goes over to a filling station, and loads up with compressed natural gas and goes out and collects garbage. And so we looked at that possibility. We looked at boiler gas. We looked at the Walmarts and other big areas around here, and would they have a need for this gas that could be directly used in their boiler? Or there was there some industry that we could attract to the industrial park next to the landfill and supply them with gas? And then we looked at just electrical generation, where you put the gas in an engine, turn a generator, produce electricity, put it on the grid and sell it. And then we looked at combined heat and power, where the engine that's producing the electricity has excess heat. Can you recover that heat and use it constructively somewhere? So the feasibility study that was done for the county was very extensive, looked at a lot of alternatives. The recommendation out of that feasibility study was that the best choice for La Crosse County was to do a combined heat and power system with a partner off-site. And what they saw in our gas and other things is they said if you work with a partner, your partner can take advantage of certain tax credits and other things that the county cannot access. And that produces additional revenue then potentially for the county. That if you'd work with a partner off-site, they can use the heat. We can't use that heat at the landfill. We have no use for that heat at the landfill. So the partner off-site. They did look at whether or not we could do just heat electric generation at the site. We could do that. We could do this project ourselves without a partner, but it was a distant second choice. Once we had this information and we discussed it with the Public Works and Infrastructure Committee, we moved on and we did a request for interest. And we asked, we put together an RFI with the purchasing department. We circulated it to a number of media contacts and organizations locally and statewide. And then we put it on our website, but we also were able to get it at LMOP. Now, LMOP is the Landfill Methane Outreach Program. It's part of EPA. We were able to get it at their national conference. And so our project had national exposure, and we were looking for perhaps a national partner to come in here and work with us. We had three responses, and I kind of filled you in at a previous meeting on this, so I'm not going to dwell on this. But what we saw was Gunderson Lutheran had the best proposal. It had the most detail. It was the most realistic. It was the most viable, and clearly, this was not a photo finish. They were a couple horse lengths ahead of everybody else on this one. So we came to you and the Public Works, and we asked if we could negotiate with Gunderson Lutheran and meet with them and see if we could form an agreement and bring it back to you for approval to see if we had a viable project. So that's where we are right now, is we're coming back to you. We believe we do have a viable project, and we will be asking for Public Works and Infrastructure's approval and then the county board's approval to move ahead with this. That was Nick's part of all the project management he's done. Now I'm going to switch into the technical part of gas from the landfills. What I'm going to talk a little bit is where does this gas come from? What is it like? How do you deal with it? What's the system for getting the gas out of the landfill? I'm going to talk to you about some operational issues that occur with this gas, and then I'm going to talk to you about some technical concerns with gas systems for that. Now, I need a laser pointer to point out some things, so I asked Nick if I could borrow his laser pointer. And yes, there it goes. So you take a landfill, and of course this is typical landfill, you put garbage in it, and you see these horizontal pipes and you see these vertical wells. That's how you get gas out of a landfill. You suck it out. Now the key for you to remember in landfills, when you put the garbage in there, the organic material decomposes. It decomposes anaerobically without air. This is going to be important in a few seconds, and I'm going to tell you why we want to run our part of the system on the landfill. Air is the enemy to this bacteria. Air will destroy these bacteria, and you won't get the methane gas. So you want to keep the inside of that landfill anaerobic. It's pretty straightforward, though. The garbage decomposes in the landfill, and through this set of pipes, you actually suck it out of the landfill. Here's what a pipe looks like, and it doesn't matter whether it's horizontal or vertical. You can lay these pipes in a trench, or you can drill them into the site. You put gravel around them, and you'll put a vacuum on the pipe, and it sucks the gas out. And so it's pretty simple. This is not rocket science. It's not hard stuff to do. You just got to put it together in the right fashion. Here's one of our gas wells, and this is Jad, our monitoring technician, our guy out at the landfill. And you can actually now see the gas well sticking up out of the landfill. That's this pipe right here. This is the wellhead that you see up here. There's a flexible hose that runs down to a header, and this is where the vacuum is. Now, all of this gas removal is very carefully controlled by DNR. Separate from this project, we have an air permit with the DNR, and we have to control the emissions from this landfill. That's a state and federal law. And so we have to monitor the temperature of the gas as it comes out. We have to monitor the oxygen content, the methane content, carbon dioxide, the pressures, etc. And we have to report on this. We have to balance this system and do a number of these things. Running a gas system is a very important part of the landfill, because if methane gas escaped from your landfill, it's 20 times more harmful to the environment than carbon dioxide is. It's a nasty greenhouse gas that you don't want released. What he's doing there is he's actually balancing it. There's a well on the top, a valve up there that he controls the vacuum to. He's taking readings in this picture, and he'll adjust the vacuum and other things. Now, if you could stand here with me for 10 years, and if this was a live picture right now, that well would grow out of the ground. Do you know why that is? When you drill a well into the landfill, it's 80 to 100 feet deep, and it stays there. The landfill settles. And so what happens, it looks like this well is growing out of the landfill. The landfill's settling. That's why you have that flexible hose, because buried under the cover is a large 12 or 14 inch pipe that's the header, and that's settling with the landfill, so you need this flexible hose, and you got to maintain all this. We're doing that already right now, and we're managing that part of the system. Now here's a place where we have a lot of headers on the site. They come together, and there's valves that control the difference in vacuum. You don't see this above ground. This is all buried, but that's how the vacuum and the different header lines to the different wells is controlled. This is our flare and blower, and you're looking at the blowers that we have. The blower is this large round device right here, and we have two. There's one here and one here. And Jad is adjusting the amount of vacuum that blower is applying to the landfill site. The blower then takes that gas and sends it. It comes out of here, it goes through here. This is a flame arrester, so that the flame from our flare, which is up here, can never come back down here and get into the pipes. What he's doing right there, that little gauge, that monitoring device, monitors the amount of gas we're producing. How much gas are we producing? 300 cubic feet a minute. I could fill this room with landfill gas in 8 minutes, to give you an idea. And that's 50% methane. In a minute and a half, with that landfill gas, this room would explode. So there's a tremendous energy value in this gas. There is a tremendous quantity that is coming out of this system. That's why these gas-to-energy projects are so interesting. Now, here is the landfill. This is an active area for our demolition. There's the flare. So that big building you saw, I'm standing on top of the landfill. This looks pretty small. There's the flare. There's the flame. There's Gunderson Lutheran. There's where the gas is going to go. They're about 2 miles away, and of course, when you shoot it with this camera and the telephoto lens, it makes it all look like it's real close, but it's about 2 miles away. And so what you do then is instead of a blower, you put a compressor in, because you're going to have to move it a greater distance. That compressor puts it into an underground pipe that would run over to Gunderson Lutheran. That would come out of the ground then, and it would go to their engines so that they can then combust the gas, produce the energy, and retrieve the heat from it. Here is an engine, pretty darn straightforward and simple. Here's where the gas comes in, goes into an engine, it's combusted. A lot of these engines have about 12 cylinders. There's a big generator on them, and that's where the electricity then comes off of the engine. If you've ever taken a tour of a submarine, you've seen something like this. They have big engines like this, but they're like diesel instead of the gas. They're typically connected to a big generator. Sure.
Is the gas, you know, the gas at Heilemann's has to be cleaned. Is the gas pure here, or does it have to be go through a cleaning process before it gets into the engine?
Excellent question. The gas in a landfill is much cleaner than what they're dealing with at Heilemann's. We have a much lower sulfur content. We have a lot less siloxanes, which is a silica compound. We've tested our gas on a number of occasions, met with Gunderson Lutheran. We're at about a tenth the limit that would be a concern for hydrogen sulfide, which can be damaging to engines, and we're about half the limit for siloxane. So our gas is highly desirable. But it does have some impurities in it. It does have an odor to it. And a good question for you is, if you got all this gas, Hank, why doesn't that landfill just explode and shower millions of tons of garbage all over the county? Why doesn't the landfill explode? Well, the reason it doesn't is that methane gas explodes when you're between 5 and 15% methane. If you're less than 5, there's not enough methane to do it. If you're above 15, it's too rich. It won't explode. Our landfill has 50% methane in it, so it's too rich. It won't do that. That's why it doesn't explode in the pipeline and other things. The only place you have to worry about it is when it mixes with the air, okay? But our gas is very clear, clean. It's something to be desired. Now, we do have moisture in it, and that can be a problem because it comes out of the landfill between 80 to 130 degrees. It's very warm. It has a lot of moisture in it. And you got to take that moisture out because if you put it in a pipeline running over to Gunderson Lutheran in the cool ground, you would get all this condensate in there that would potentially plug your pipe. So what we do is we knock out the condensate with a demister. But in a gas-to-energy project, you actually cool the gas after you compressed it, before you put it in the pipeline, and it's just like a dehumidifier that takes the moisture out. Then you put it through a heat exchanger right there at the compressor. You heat the gas back up. I know that sounds crazy, but you take the moisture out, you heat the gas back up, you put it in the pipeline, and then you don't get the gas coming out. That's important for our user on the other end to have that moisture taken out because we don't want that affecting the engine. The other thing we do is we also have a screen in there that takes out particulates. We don't want little sand grains and other things going through that system and getting into their engine. Let's take a look at what an engine really looks like. Here's a couple different pictures. These are engines in a building. Here's three of them. Here's a big engine just like I just showed you. Here's a building that's got six different engines in it with all the electrical connections. There's all sorts of configurations. There's small engines. There's big engines. We're looking at a kind of modest size engine. It's not the biggest, and we're only looking at one for this project. They don't have to be in buildings. Here are engines that are actually put into a large container that you can then put in a fenced area behind a building. You can see some of the big mufflers they have on them to control noise, etc. That is on Gunderson Lutheran's end of the project, though. The engine and generating the electricity is on their end of the project. Again, not new technology. There's about 35 different engines and projects in the state. There are some sites that have three, four engines, and they call that three or four projects, but it's one landfill that has three or four engines. Ours would have just one. On a national basis, there's hundreds of these projects that already exist out there. And so this isn't something we have to plow new ground on, nothing that we're going to have to experiment with. Proven technologies out there, so it's just a matter of putting the project together in the correct fashion. What are the costs of these projects? Well, a project about our size, the total capital cost is going to be in that $3 to $3.5 million, and you have to decide then how do you share that with your partner. What percentage is going to be invested? The part we're interested in is to take the gas out of the landfill, compress it, and put it into the pipeline over to Gunderson Lutheran. Now, why would I be interested in doing that part? Well, I'm interested in it because the county has the air permit, and we're responsible for the operation of that landfill. If you allow somebody else to operate the landfill and they suck the gas out of the landfill, and you violate your air permits because they don't suck enough gas out and you have emissions, or they suck too much out and you can have another problem, then we are held in violation of that air permit. So I want to run the compressor. I want to adjust that field and produce the gas and provide it to the user. Now, remember when I said aerobic landfill and why that was important? Here's how the engine and the compressor work. The engine is over here at Gunderson Lutheran. We have the compressor over here. Now, these are electronically coupled together, and it's just like when you're on the highway and you put your car on cruise, okay? Their engine is working to produce electricity. If the heat value in the methane gas goes down a little bit, their engine sends a signal to our compressor, and it says, turn a few more RPMs and pump me a little bit more gas, okay? And it does that, and it provides a little bit more gas, and the engine runs, and it produces the electricity. Where you can have a problem is when this engine starts demanding more and more gas because the heat value or something went down, if you don't control it on this end, it continues to suck gas out of your landfill, and what does it draw into the landfill? Air. Air's got oxygen. It kills the bacteria that are producing the methane. As you kill the bacteria that are producing the methane, you get less heat value. The engine doesn't know that's going on, so what the engine does says, pump harder. You draw more air in. You kill more bacteria. You begin to hurt the landfill. I've been on sites where we've overpumped them, and we created an underground fire in the landfill because we drew too much air into the site, and that is a problem. We want to maintain control of the compressor and other things. We want to deliver the best quality gas to Gunderson Lutheran, but because the air permit's in our name and we're responsible to that and we're running the site, we want to control that end of the project. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about is that when these projects, when you talk about a gas project like this, if we have the control of the compressor and the pipeline, that's an investment of between $1 and $1.5 million. Well, is that a big project for the solid waste department? No. We build cells out at the landfill that commonly go from $1 million to $3 million. We build them in a year. We're comfortable building and managing projects of this dollar magnitude. And as you know, with the waste relocation, we went through some projects that were $6 and $8 million that we spent. So we're very comfortable managing projects at this level. Here's a timeline of the things that we've done. I kind of explained all these things to you in the history that we've gone through. This is where we are right now. We're continuing to refine some of our economics, the contract language, and Gary and David are going to talk about those in a second. Gunderson Lutheran has reviewed this, and they have approved this. Their boards have approved this in the last week or so. They desire to go ahead. We're now providing you this information tonight so that you can ask questions and you'll be comfortable next week when we bring this to you and ask for approval to move this project forward and enter into an agreement. The work that's ahead of us is that if we receive your approval in August, then we're going to have to start design work, permitting work. That's going to take a couple months. And then what we're going to do is construction, and construction will be in the form of an engine and other things that will be ordered. You won't see anything on the ground. And then it'll be in spring that you'll actually see construction. Now, there's a critical time date in this calendar, and it's critical to our partner. December 31st of 2010, there are certain treasury credits, bond credits, tax credits that will expire. And unless a 5% commitment is made on the project through our partner, they would not be eligible for certain financial incentives to the project. And Gary will talk about this a little bit more in the financial section, but without those financial incentives, this project is not desirable to Gunderson Lutheran. And we would probably not go forward, and they would say, if you want to do a gas to energy project, you're going to have to do it yourself, because those treasury grants are so important to our financial picture. So if we, for example, if we didn't have approval, then we may not have a partner at the end of the year. We'd have to see if treasury grants would be renewed for the next year. We'd have to look at those things. So that's the one critical timeline that we are facing. I'm going to stop, rest my voice here, and turn it over to Gary to talk about the financial aspects. Mind if I take a few questions?
Yeah, I think we got questions. Let's do that first. Monica Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have actually three questions that are sort of related, and I'm just kind of wondering, you know, if you can give me an overview here. First of all, is there an unlimited amount of methane in this landfill? I mean, do we have, you know, huge amounts? What percentage of it are we able to access with these rods that we're putting down there? And is there a lifetime of profitability? I mean, are we going to run out of this stuff, or is it just going to keep generating, you know, at huge amounts that, you know, we'll never be able to you know, siphon down? So just kind of give me an idea.
Sure. It's not unlimited. We expect that it's going to increase from around 300 cubic feet a minute around to perhaps 450, maybe up to 600 in the next 20 or so years. But then it's going to decrease when we close the land. It's going to stay at a level thing for about another 10 years. But then after 30 years, it's going to start to decrease when we close the site. And that there will come a period, probably in 40 or 50 years from now, that this project may not be feasible. There may not be enough gas.
Maureen Friedland.
Yeah, first of all, correct me if I've got any of this wrong, but as I understand, this project is going to produce gas that's actually going to be used at Gunderson Lutheran up in Onalaska.
That's correct.
Okay, and the project at Heilemann produces gas that goes on the grid rather than to Gunderson. Is that correct?
It produces gas that is converted into electricity that goes onto the grid. Our project will produce gas that's converted to electricity. Gunderson will put it in their grid. Their facility may use it, or it may go on the grid, and it totally depends upon demand. But then they're going to recover the heat off that engine and use that to heat the buildings. That's a more unique part of our project here.
Okay, yeah. I was just wondering what the different considerations were, because it seems like the distance is about the same, the landfill to the Onalaska Clinic or the Heilemann to the main campus, isn't it?
Well, plus also the amount of gas they have is a lot less.
Okay.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Don Vina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of questions. There will not be a holding tank on the line between our facility and theirs, then the gas will continually flow without being a reservoir anyplace?
That's correct.
Okay, then what happens if their motor goes down for some reason, or you have a power outage? What happens to our gas that we cannot use at that point in time?
Excellent question. If their generator goes down, or they have to take it down for repairs, then we keep our backup flare at the site, just like that you see, and our air permit requires that within less than 24 hours, if their generator is down, we have to relight our flare and burn that gas off.
Okay, so we're not getting rid of the flare then?
Right.
Okay. The last question, you know, years ago we did some analysis and there wasn't enough gas coming out of the old landfill. I don't know why, but we never thought it was feasible to do anything with this. Now, did we redesign the new pods so that we gather more gas than what the old landfill had years ago? Are we creating more now from what we're doing?
No. Now, the answer is going to be a little bit complicated. The old landfill didn't have good caps and other things. It had a lot of water in it.
True.
The gas collection system was not good, and so they didn't recover it well out of that
site. Yeah, we had a fire out there one time, too, so that didn't help.
The new site has a better cover and has a better gas collection system. And so actually, to go back to your question, how much gas are we actually collecting? What's our efficiency? We're probably in that 85-90% of all the methane generated we're collecting. In the old sites, we may not have even been at 50%. That's part of the difference. The other part of the difference is that the new site, its garbage is plain fresher than what the old site was, and so it's generating better quality gas.
Don Meyer.
Hank, you talked about River States Trucking and Gunnarsson Lutheran. How far could you realistically go for another customer? Assume this goes and you have want another customer. How far, how many miles away could you really go?
There is a pipeline in the Milwaukee area that they're talking about 25 miles. Highly unusual, high amount of gas, et cetera. 2 miles isn't bad. When you start getting over the 4 to 6, you better have a lot of gas and you better have a good user. This is very good. This is feasible. When you start getting over 4 to 6, we better have more gas and we better have a more, you know, we'd want a different type user perhaps.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we heard this last time Gunnarsson Lutheran was here, but what percent of their energy needs will be met by this project for their Onalaska campus?
If I understand it right, I believe 100% of their energy for the Onalaska campus will be met by this project. So they will be totally on renewable energy at this campus. And I believe about 14% of their renewable energy will be met then. This is very big to them.
Cool. Any other questions for Hank? Jeff Shader.
Is there a reason that that we wouldn't have our own engine and sell what we produce there?
In other words, put an electric generating engine on our property. In the feasibility study that we looked at, what we saw is that if we produce the energy, we get none of the tax credits or advantages. If a partner does that, he gets them, and then he can offer us a higher price for the gas. That was one. The second thing is, if we produce our own energy with our engine, instead of looking at $1 million to $1.5 million project, I'm going to have to talk to you about a $3 million project, and I'm going to have to hire some people. Because when you run and put an engine on your property, you have a lot more care running into that engine. Running a compressor on our property, we're already running the blowers with JAD. So we believe we're going to be able to cover the operation of this with JAD, not add people for this gas system. So the big reason is would be more capital if we did it, there would be a staffing. We'd have to have more staffing for that, and we don't think it'd be as financially as desirable.
Any other questions? Dan Ferries.
So with what Gunderson Lutheran would consume, is there quite an excess of gas, a surplus left over?
No.
That would pretty much exhaust it?
They're going to suck us dry. and we're working with them about that. There's different engines they can choose. And, you know, the engine they're looking at is about 335 cubic feet a minute. I mentioned I'm producing 300. We think we're going to get to 335. So they're going to consume all the gas. You know, we're looking at the possibility, if we have a 15-year contract with them, for example, if they bought a bigger engine and we produce more gas halfway through the contract, then would that help? And would that be desirable to both parties? So we're looking at that. But basically, with this agreement, they would be our one customer, and we would not have excess gas for other people.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Ralph, Gary.
Thank you. Do we need any kind of special security for this? Do we need any security?
Additional security? Oh, out at the landfill site?
When you put this in, for this. You know, in this day and age, everybody's worrying about security on something. You were talking about an explosion if it mixes right and all this stuff.
Yep. No, there's nothing special. There are certain rules and regulations you have to comply to with the pipeline. We're already complying with rules and regulations with the wiring, the fencing, and the other things around there. There's no special security. On Gunderson Lutheran's end, they'll have to look at their fencing and how to keep the public out, but it's not special.
Anybody else? All right, Hank, thanks. Gary.
It's going to be kind of difficult for me to follow our entertaining engineer, but I do want to say, after working with Hank now for a couple of years, his intelligence far exceeds his ability to entertain. So the entertainment's kind of like the icing on the cake. We appreciate that. I want to mention that in addition, of course, to the La Crosse staff of Nick and Dave Lang and myself and Hank that have been working on this, I want to acknowledge the staff from Gunderson Lutheran that we've been meeting with. And I've probably been in probably about a half a dozen meetings, but I specifically want to mention Jeff Rich, who is here with us tonight. Jeff is the executive director for major projects and efficiency improvement for Gunderson Lutheran. Jeff has pretty much been the lead person from Gunderson Lutheran, but in our meetings, there's pretty much, Jeff has also had another engineer there. Their corporate attorney's also been there. Their chief financial officer's been there, along with another accountant from Gunderson Lutheran. So there's been a lot of time, not only in the meetings, but in doing, you know, homework, so to speak, in between the meetings. One thing that we wanted to establish up front when we first got together, we were both aware of the fact that both Gunderson Lutheran and La Crosse County have a big presence in the area, so we wanted to make sure that this was a positive project. We also wanted to make sure that it was as fair as possible, because 2 years from now, we didn't want to see something in a newspaper that one was taking advantage of the other. So we wanted this to be a mutual project that was beneficial for both parties. Hank actually did touch a little bit about the capital investment. Right now, they are estimates. Even though Gunderson Lutheran has done a preliminary RFP, the actual RFPs that go out will be done separately. And I think they're actually going to probably issue another one in addition to the preliminary one. But the county will follow our purchasing policy. So our investment is not specifically, I mean, the proposal is not specifically tied to whoever they contract with. We're going to try to get the best bang for our buck. And as Hank mentioned, right now we think it's going to be, our investment will be about $1.1 million, could be as high as possibly $1.4 million. We won't know until we get the proposals back in. The thing with it is when another thing that we talked about when we were meeting is that
You know, with La Crosse County, we can't afford to make any financial mistakes. We made that real clear with them, and they understood that. So we wanted to take, so to speak, the least risk in the venture, and in so doing, our payback will be in approximately 5 years. Again, we'll know better once we get the proposals back. A five-year return on our investment, that would be about 22% per year, which is a pretty good return. The revenue that we would be obtaining within the first 5 years would be about $300,000 per year. So we would clearly, even after some of our operating expenses, we would earn our investment back within 5 years. There is money available in the solid waste budget, or in the fund balance, I should say, for solid waste to fund this project, so we don't have to go out and borrow any money for it. I also want to mention, as is up on the screen up there, solid waste, again, is an enterprise fund. There will not be any county property tax levy involved with this. It will be strictly funded through the solid waste operations. As far as the last item up there, last bullet point, other options studied, again, Hank kind of touched on that. We talked a lot in our meetings about, you know, who should buy the equipment. Should Gunderson buy all of it? Should we buy all of it? I think Hank has already addressed that issue. We talked again about it's possible we could have gotten a little bit more in the revenues per year, but if we would have done that, we would have had to take some more risk, so to speak, in the revenues that come through Excel and so forth and so on. So we feel real comfortable, the team does, with where we're at with this right now, and we'll bring some more solid numbers back to you in the future. So,
questions for Gary? Anybody? Marine Friedland.
Yeah, I think this is a wonderful project. This really does satisfy some of our sustainability goals of reusing what we're producing. But it occurs to me that another one of our sustainability goals is to really is to reduce the amount of consumption that we have, to reduce, reuse, recycle, and so forth. What about if our community were to move towards the goal of a zero waste community, where we just weren't producing as much garbage that was going to go to the landfill, and in 15 or 20 years, maybe even when the contract to Excel expires, we don't have as much garbage going to the landfill. How does that work into this project, which is a long-term project, and anticipating, Hank said, about a 30-year lifespan? I just, you know, reconcile that for me in my little brain.
I think it would be best if Hank would answer that question.
Zero waste is a concept that would put me out of business, and we embrace it. Believe it or not, garbage people embrace that concept of zero waste. We have a lot of diversion programs. And so that's not something that is counterproductive to the La Crosse system. The La Crosse system embraces that idea. What I have seen is that in our society, this does not move fast. This is not going to happen in a matter of a couple years. It may be a decade before we see some significant changes. This project is designed for 15 years. That engine has a life that after 15 years, we're going to have to look at this, and we may either have no project, or we might have a bigger engine or a smaller engine. Okay? So we really got to look at 15 years in the life here of the contract. The other thing you got to keep in mind is I've got millions of tons of garbage in that site that are producing this gas. Some of that garbage is just starting to produce. And so over this 15-year life, we're fairly confident this project is going to work as we're predicting. That is a question, though, that if this county seriously embraces zero waste and you start taking food waste out of our system and you start taking other things, and you start doing a better job of recycling papers and other things going into the site, that will affect the long-term quality of the gas, and we'll have to look at that at the 15-year point and say we don't have enough gas to support a system or not. So it's a legitimate question, but for this project, we're fairly confident the waste in the landfill will produce the gas we need.
Just one more little question. Does it affect any of the negotiation then that will start in the next couple years about with Xcel about renewing the contract in 2021 or whenever it is that it expires?
Absolutely, and that's why we need your input on the policy board. because those are big questions. Even though we got 13 years left on the Xcel contract, we got to start talking now about what is our future. If we take out more paper and other things, after 2023, will that RDF fuel mixture be suitable for Xcel or not? So that same issue has to be examined from Xcel's standpoint. You do have choices, though. At that point, and if we see that decline, do we take in more waste from outside of the system? Is Monroe County and Vernon County going to go out of the landfill business and come to us and say, please take our waste for us? I don't know. Those are all the interesting things that we're talking about, though.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was very similar to Supervisor Friedland's, and I was interested in, and I think my question was answered, I was interested in what kind of market risk we would be taking. I know we've heard we're exposed to this kind of market risk with our contract with Xcel Energy. Economy declines. There's less waste taken to the facility. Therefore, we have an obligation to meet a certain amount of tonnage each year. And, of course, that we're exposed to market risk. So I'm, based on that answer then, there's no market risk to this, or it's very minimal in terms of the amount of gas generated from the that would be generated from the facility.
Let me divide your question into two things. What is the risk that we have that we generate not enough gas? We've been looking pretty hard at that, and right now we're running about 20 cubic feet a minute ahead of what all the models are saying for our site. Our site says, and these are EPA models and other things, that it's going to continue to grow. We think that risk is small. There's a risk that we might produce too much gas that their engine can't handle, and we'd have excess gas, and then we might have to do something else. And so we looked at those risks. We think they're reasonable. We got a number of alternatives that we can employ at the landfill to handle those. At the beginning of our discussions with Gunderson Lutheran, though, we had some really good talks about market risk. And Gary was a real steadying force. He said, we don't want market risk, and so we're not going to tie our gas prices to natural gas or anything else. That here is what today's price of natural gas is. You'll pay us this many dollars per million BTUs for the first 8 years. And so we're assured of getting this revenue on the gas we produce, and we're not taking any risk as to what the price of natural gas or anything is in that first 8 years. So that's how we mitigated market risk in the financial portion of it to make sure we got our payback in terms that we desired. Now, on the same token, we don't want to sit back, though, and say that we don't want to enter into taking some long-term risk here. And so Dave is going to kind of share with you in the contract in the next couple seconds that after the 8 years, our contract changes. Instead of getting a flat price, we take a rolling average price of the gas, and that's how we get compensated for our gas. And so what we're banking on, and I think this is a safe assumption, in 8 years the price of natural gas is going to go up. I'm pretty sure it's going to go up. Okay, but by using the rolling average, we're not going to play this game 1 year up, 1 year down. We're going to average it out, and so I expect our pricing to go like this, nice gradual incline over this project. That's how we managed market risk of the gas price.
Okay, thank you. And so I'm assuming then, Gary, that you'll give us a whole risk analysis of all the things in your report eventually when we get this, of all the other risks that we'd be incurring?
Well, I mean, certainly as staff, we've made a list of the potential risks, and we feel that we are addressing those as we go along. Again, I mean, nothing is guaranteed, but we really feel that it's like I mentioned to the group in the first meeting, La Crosse County is risk averse. So,
So I mean, but it won't be hard to put those ideas on paper just so we know what those are. Just so we obviously
yeah,
we'll
some,
get
I
that.
Mean, some of the basic risks that we can possibly foresee, we can put that on paper. Again, nothing is guaranteed.
Sure, absolutely.
And we actually have put the risks on paper. We've had an internal discussion. Tomorrow night at Public Works Infrastructure Committee, as a follow-up to this meeting, I'd be happy to bring that list to the meeting for further discussion.
Jack Spiker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hank, will it affect our partners that are in waste energy?
Xcel. Well, they support renewable energy and everything else. They're required by state law to enter into the agreements with Gunderson Lewthan for the interconnect agreement. Xcel, I think, realizes that with this project, they're going to lose some gas sales to Gunderson Lewthan because of this. But they are supporting this. This will not have any impact on our Xcel waste-to-energy plant in terms of our refuse there, electricity production there, or anything in the relationship there.
Will it affect other counties that deliver to the RDF plant that are partners in this till 2023? Will it affect them at all, or they have input? Or?
No. And we kind of made this clear, I think it was at the last policy board meeting, that the gas-to-energy project is a solid waste project, that those revenues are in the solid waste department and are not shared with our communities. They go into the solid waste department.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand this, Gunderson will have a fixed rate per million BTUs of 8 years, not indexed for inflation.
That is correct.
That seems pretty good deal. I'd love to sign a contract like that for my home. And if we're going to have a payback after 5, why wouldn't we start the rolling after 5 years instead of 8? Because by then you've got your payback. It just doesn't make sense to me. It seems that they're getting and again, the project is wonderful. It just seems that if we're so concerned about getting a fair value, that after that 5 years when our investment is back, that would be the time to go to the rolling. And again, when we were talking about the jail, you kept talking about how these energy costs were going to escalate and we should figure that in towards going green. Well, it seems that we're not using that same philosophy in this particular project.
A couple, I guess, responses. First of all, after a lot of in-depth analysis, we feel that the $3.50 they're giving us per MMBTU is a very attractive rate. I mean, we've researched that up and down, inside and out. Second of all, Gunderson Lutheran's payback will not be as quick as ours. So again, I mean, you know, we have to do this as a partnership. I'm not sure that they'd be willing to do something earlier than 8 years.
So, okay, so that's just part of the contract. So we have the potential to subsidize them by giving them a fixed. I guess I would almost like to see that tied into inflation rate or something also, at least. It seems to me that they're getting.
Can I try a little bit? Because I've reviewed a lot of these numbers as well. Gary's been the lead. Gunderson Lutheran is actually investing more and taking a longer payback because of their long-term interest in this. So if you remember, the total project is about $1.1 million is our investment. $2.4 million is their investment. They're taking longer to actually get paid back. Initially, they get that 30% upfront, which is the tax credit that they're getting back, but then they're counting on the ability to depreciate and see this over a longer term. So that's why we've negotiated on us taking less risk and getting our money back quicker. They're interested in getting it over a long time, but fixing the dollar amount that they're paying us per million BTUs. If we wanted to get to have a more fluctuating rate, we take more risk, we'd probably put more money in, and we'd take more risk now under that type of concept. And Dave actually did a lot of the negotiations.
Can I maybe add, and we've also talked to other people, such as a representative from Fulth, who has dealt with a number of these projects, and we've gone over these numbers, and basically he also agrees that that's a very good price. The amount that we've talked about receiving, even though it's a fixed amount, it's a very good price, and given the rate of return we get versus what they are getting, that we're getting a good deal.
Yeah, the payback sounds good. I was just surprised that it would be a fixed, non-indexed amount. Again, because we talk so much about our project with the jail, of, you know, basing it on energy was going to rise 7%, 12%, whatever that thing. I was just surprised to hear that.
I understand. We did talk about that, and we also talked about sharing in the risk, sharing in the benefits early on, sharing in these credits, because we don't know where they're going to go. And basically what we got into was, okay, do you want to share the risk? Then you have to share the benefit. You have to share the loss. And we pretty much came down and said, no, we want something that we know is going to give us the payback, something that's safer.
Other hands? Bill Feehan.
My question is, what's the payback to the taxpayer here? We're going to invest the $1.1 million, and it's a great project, and I commend everybody on the work they've done. I think the agreement sounds reasonable. But I'm just curious if this is going to be generating $300,000 in revenue, where will that revenue go?
Well, I'll translate that question, and will that affect the tipping fees? Might those come down? Nobody wants to answer that one?
Well, actually, this will be a 2012 budget decision, because that's when you are actually going to start having the revenue. That'll be a policy decision made by this body, but it will go back into the solid waste operation. So ultimately, it will affect the cost effectiveness of that entire operation. But you won't start budgeting for it until the project is actually constructed. So it'll be for the 2012 budget. But it's our intention as your staff that it comes back into the solid waste operation and helps control long-term costs within that entity.
This question was raised in our discussions, and we got all excited about the revenue. Steve said, look, you can't eat your cake until you bake it. And we're not going to have this system online until September of 2011. We won't see the revenues to 2012. So he said, stop spending the money to us staff. And he said, allow the county board in 2011 to carry on that discussion, what the revenues are going to be used for when we do the 2012 budget.
So the answer to the question is, we will decide if that will affect the tipping fees. That'll be this board's decision. Prof. Geary.
Well, my question was more like, does the our solid waste area actually have any say in this matter on the revenue after it's paid off? They're supplying some of the garbage and that goes in here. Do they have any say in this at all? And if the tipping fee should go down after, I'm talking about 5 years from now, but do they have any contractual or legal or any voice in this? You know, Wabasha might say, you know, we're paying, we can haul our garbage someplace for $50 a ton, but now that we got all this extra money, maybe we can lower the tipping fee to this. Can they leverage, or do they have any say at all? Hank? Or whoever knows about that?
We have treated this project as this is an operational issue. This is not a regional issue or anything else. We operate that gas system. We report to the Public Works Infrastructure Committee. They govern how we operate that site, and they pass on recommendations to the county board what we're going to do with that revenue. While it is an exciting amount, and it could be, you know, up to $300,000 a year, in a $10 million budget, it isn't that significant. It's important, but it's not that significant. And so they're providing the garbage. We have to manage it. Part of our management is to collect that gas and burn it. If we get some revenue that helps offset operational costs or other things, that's our business, nobody else's.
Dave, did your thunder get stolen already, or do you have anything further?
Well, there's not going to be a lot left, but there's a little bit.
Okay, Dave.
Press this. Okay.
Okay. I just have a few points. I'm Dave Lane. You normally see Bill Shepard, and most of you know me, a few new faces. We've been involved with these negotiations now for several months, almost on a weekly basis. As Gary's indicated, the negotiations have been quite open. We're partners. We're dealing with this as if we're partners, not as if we're doing this tough negotiation back and forth. It's like, okay, we're open. They show us what they have. And we've talked very openly about how we can make this a win-win situation where we both benefit and try to make it as fair as possible. And that's what we try to do with the contract, too. I've had a number of contracts provided to me from around the country because we're not the first ones to do this. It gives me some ideas. But we pretty much have to draft this for our situation. It's really pretty basic. We have the gas. That's our asset. We're selling that biogas and telling Gunderson Lutheran, you have the rights to our biogas. And in exchange, you will pay a certain price for that, a fixed price for the first 8 years, and you will agree to use it. So that's the basic agreement. We'll get it to you. You'll agree to use it. And after the eighth year, as I think Hank already explained, we're gonna have that price based on the three-year rolling average. And the reason for that is because by that time, we will have paid back on our investment. And hopefully, gas prices will go up, so we'll be able to have a better price at that time. If it goes down, if it's going up and down, the three-year rolling average gives us some protection. So hopefully that will work out well. The 15 years is the term because we're looking at after about 8 years, there may have to be some a maintenance on the generator and on the compressor. Then after 15 years, then we'll see what happens. The three possible five-year renewals are possible. It's not automatic. If the board and Gunderson Lutheran at that point feel like they can go further, we'll see how things go. Like some of the discussion was, what's it going to be like in 15 years? We're not sure. So by that point, I guess we'll be able to see. The basic idea is at this point that we will purchase and be responsible for the compressor and the conditioner on site for the reasons that Hank already went into, and the pipeline to get it to their area. That also means that we're going to have to go have an easement to get down to the interstate, go under that with the pipe, and down to their property. We've been looking into that to see exactly what we need, and it looks like that's a very viable thing that we can do. We have an access easement right now from North Kinikuli Road up to the landfill. I don't think there'll be any problem having having permission to use that also for this pipeline. We will be responsible for that equipment. We will need to maintain it. We're responsible and own the gas until it gets to what we'll call a point of delivery, where it gets to the Gunderson site to go to the generator. At that point, it becomes their gas. They're responsible for the generator. They're responsible for interconnecting it to whatever they need to do for to the grid. They're responsible for any interconnection to their facilities, to heat those facilities. And they'll be responsible for any maintenance. The agreement will have your standard provisions for insurance. If there's acts of God, neither party is responsible. We'll have a dispute resolution. Could be arbitration, could be going to court. We have certain details we still need to work out on that, but I just wanted to give you what the general idea is. We will provide a certain commercial quality of gas. There'll be a definition of that. That's important because we have to say, okay, we will make sure that doesn't have too many silicones. We'll make sure it's of a certain quality, at least a minimum quality for their engines, and they will provide that to them. If we don't over, let's say, 3 or 4 consecutive months, that's a problem. In turn, they also agree that they'll take it and they'll use it, and they'll keep their generator going and they'll use it. And if they don't do that for a certain length of time, that's a problem. But that we'll address in the contract. But that's basically what it is. We'll give you a certain quality of gas. You agree to use it. And we've gone over a lot of these details for a period of time. It looks like it's going to work well. I, as an attorney, I always am somewhat cautious and feel like, well, I hope, you know, is this? I hope everything goes off without a glitch. But all we can do is protect things as best we can. But that's basically what it is. The negotiations have been open and they've gone well. If you have any questions, I'll be willing to answer it. Again, more details we'll have to work out as we go along. But that's generally what we've talked about right now.
Any more questions? Anybody have any? Ray Ebert.
You know, I guess I'm surprised that we're going to own the pipeline. Of that 1.1 to 1.4 million, how much of that is for the pipeline?
I think some of the estimates have varied, you know.
About half a million.
That sounds about right.
So about half the project, because it seems to me that where we get into liability problems, that pipeline would certainly be the substantial amount of where things could go bad for us.
Well, and we've talked about that. You know, I've talked about that with Hank, with the engineers. Is there a lot of liability? There's some, but they don't seem to think that there is that much. And basically, for the bottom line, it makes it more viable financially for us, too.
It makes it more viable for us or for them?
For us, I think.
Because I initially I would have thought we should do it, just give Gunderson the gas. They provide everything. Hank convinced me that we should, you know, operate the part on our property, and I can buy that. I guess I'm just not convinced that once it gets off our property, it's in our best interest to own and be in the pipeline business. And I think, I hope we would look at that that part of it particularly. I think we might want to look at again. Thank you.
Right. Hank, can you address that from the technical standpoint?
Yeah.
Financial and technical standpoints. When we looked at all the equipment, the maintenance, how you got to operate things and everything else, the pipeline is particularly attractive. You stick it in the ground and it lays there. You don't do anything to it. And so to us, it's low maintenance. It's absolutely no operation. And so we put the capital in that. We don't have a lot of O&M on that system at all. And so as we put together the financial picture then with Gunderson Lutheran and ourselves, we looked at it and said that's a good investment for us in that we have very low operation and maintenance cost with that, et cetera, and it takes a headache away from them, okay? Now, the other way I looked at this, and this is a personal philosophy, and I think very highly of Gunderson and many other operations, but if we put that pipeline in public right-of-way, who would you rather have overseeing it, the county of La Crosse or a private enterprise? Personally, I would like to have the county manage that pipeline. We're concerned about the public aspects of it. So again, I want to be involved with that pipeline in the public right-of-ways.
Well, if that's true, then all NSP, all of their underground natural gas stuff, then we should be running that also?
No, because transmission lines are very different than this.
Well, isn't this basically a transmission line from our point to theirs?
It is a transmission line. It is different from the standpoint of how it is maintained and a number of other things.
Thank you, sir.
All right, anybody else? Okay, guys, that was great. Thank you very much. Very informative. Board will be voting on this in August, so any questions that you have that were not answered tonight, contact one of these folks and run it by them. So be ready for the vote in August. We have one more item on the agenda, and that is economic development. No. Roll them.
Okay, I get to start on this one because it starts talking about history, and I'm the oldest speaker in the group here. In fact, I think the oldest one up here. So anyway, I guess that's an honor. I just want to give you a little bit of background of economic development since I've worked at the county, which is 33 years now. Mr. Geary, Mr. Spiker, maybe there's somebody else that I'm forgetting, have been around as long as I have. Steve Doyle, of course, has been here since the mid-80s, I believe, as some of the others have. Anyway, throughout the 70s and 80s, now this is my interpretation, it seemed that the county was somewhat torn about the role in economic development and the sale of land. One thing that surprised me when I looked through my old files, which I had forgotten about, actually in the late 70s, there was a resolution passed by the county board for a 10-year moratorium on the land sales at the county farm. So, you know, again, that was the thought process, that was the preference of the county at the time. They wanted to preserve the farmland. In fact, we were still in the farm business. I had forgotten that it wasn't until 1987 that we got, or 1989 actually, that we got out of the farm business. We had been milking cows. We had two or three full-time employees. Obviously, it was very good farmland. In fact, that brings to mind, again, part of the reason why some county board members didn't want to break it up out there is because it was very, very good farmland. In addition, then, to selling off the farm machinery, the dairy herd, and the farmhouse, West Salem, of course, being adjacent to the farm, had always been, for many years, interested in buying some land, so we did sell some land to them. Now, aside from the county wanting to preserve the farm, we were, though, taking an active role in contributing to groups, economic groups, going back again for as long as I can remember, specifically Mississippi River Regional Planning. You know, you heard from Greg tonight. They've been an extremely valuable partner with La Crosse County and other surrounding counties. LADCO, La Crosse Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, ITBEC, Downtown Main Street, City of La Crosse Airport. We were always concerned about providing whatever economic support that we could. We thought we should contribute a fair share to the success of those entities. Now, in the early 90s, we progressed a little bit further. And there was actually a 1990 economic development plan that was put out by the Economic Development Committee at the time. And again, keep in mind that we had an Economic Development Committee. It was a pretty much like a subcommittee at the time. But one of the strategies was, and I'm going to read this, by being involved in local economic development, the county board can better understand its economic problems. This better understanding puts the board in a better position to solve or mitigate their problems, which may involve the board influencing state and federal policy through their legislators. Maybe the last part there hasn't been real successful, but again, the county board was taking a direction of being more directly involved. The university extension agent at the time created a booklet that was basically a resource for business startups or even existing businesses of assistance that could be provided locally, federally, or by the state. And then in 1992, we established the County's Industrial Development Agency. It's actually a nonprofit, non-stock corporation. That was started in conjunction with Mississippi River Regional Planning, again, a long-term partner that continues to be a long-term partner. Mississippi River Regional Planning's role was the loan administration. They would accept loan applications and then go through the due diligence of getting the paperwork, and then they would bring it to the committee, the county committee, with some citizen members from the banking industry. Now, the Lakeview land came up again in 1994. There was actually a Lakeview Land Study Committee. Ralph, you were on that. Steve Doyle was on there. Again, looking through the minutes, it was interesting about the variations of what board members thought should be done with the Lakeview land. So then moving on to the next slide here. As I mentioned, there was the Economic Development Committee. At this point in time, the County's Industrial Development Agency, the Revolving Loan Fund, technically called the La Crosse County Business Fund. We also, in an effort, I think, particularly when Chairman Doyle became chairman and when we hired Steve O'Malley as the county administrator, Steve had extensive experience in the city of Burnsville and other Rice County and other counties that he had worked for in economic development. It's always been a passion of his. So with the two leading us into even a further more active role, we got a county planner, Charlie, of course, full-time, and also in 2005 hired Brian Facuto, who again has been a great asset to our mission to be more aggressive in economic development. So at this point in time, I'm going to turn it over to Brian.
Thanks, Gary. I want to give you a little bit of a warning and an apology in advance that this might at some point start to sound like puffy self-promotion, but it's really because we're really proud of what we do. So going on to the next slide of talking about our current role in economic development, we kind of serve as the Department of Economic Development, Community Development, Planning, Collaboration, Organization, Education, Grant Writing, but we're not actually a department at all. We're more of a cross-departmental work group. We have a foundation as an economic development work group. We're led by the County Administrator's Office, involving our base work group involves the County Administrator. Myself as the Community Development Specialist, Charlie Handy, the County Planner, and Carl Green, who's the UW Extension Conrad agent. We also work quite a bit with a lot of the other departments, the Corporation Council Office, the Finance, Facilities, Solid Waste, Zoning and Land Information, amongst others. But we really try to work together with those other departments to lead efforts to complete complex projects. We also work. We also serve as a cross-organizational work group. We feel that efficiency is gained through collaboration. So more often than not, we're working with other organizations, such as the municipalities of the county, the school districts, area nonprofits, businesses, state and federal governments, among others. But we really serve as a cross-organizational work group that just tries to add value. As my position was created, I was told that I needed to find out where I could add value to the efforts of the individual municipalities and other economic development entities across the county. So we've tried to do that over the last 4.5, going on 5 years. So what do we do? It's kind of a complex answer. In general, we try to work on projects that will improve the quality of life of La Crosse County. So what does that mean? Jobs, housing, cultural resources, education, economy, all of those types of things come to mind. Specifically, we talk about a lot of ongoing activities that we participate in. The revolving loan funds have been mentioned a couple of times. There was a handout in your packet that provides some of the detail on our revolving loan funds. The top of that talks about the establishment of those revolving loan funds. We actually have three separate funds, a county fund, a state fund, and a federal fund funded through those resources. This handout talks about that. The main idea is really that we were able to capitalize those funds, and now we're able to use those funds to revolve back into the community to help more businesses to establish and grow within La Crosse County. We generally provide gap financing. We've to date made 28 loans of just about $3.3 million, leveraging almost $20 million in private funds into those projects and creating 270 jobs. You can refer to that handout if you have any other questions on the revolving loan funds. I'm happy to answer them. We also staff the La Crosse County Economic Development Fund on an ongoing basis. There were also a couple of handouts in your packet. One that's just kind of a committee introduction and orientation. It gives you some background information on why and how that was created. It gives you the committee membership as well as some of the duties and responsibilities and some of the current projects that committee is working on. The other handout in your packet was the 2009-2010 goals for that committee. We do a twice a year we revisit those goals and try to set our priorities for what we as staff should be working on. So again, you can refer to that in your packets, and if you have questions about that, I'm happy to answer that. Other ongoing activities, we deal a lot with just business development assistance and site selection assistance. We get calls periodically from businesses that are looking to either locate or relocate within La Crosse County. We help them find sites. We look for financing options for them, be it industrial revenue bonds or TIF assistance or state grants or just affordable land or however we might be able to assist businesses as they look to develop and grow within La Crosse County. There's a number of businesses that we've helped to succeed and grow here, and not all of them are real visible projects, but we've worked with a number of businesses and helped them to be successful, and that's really, you know, one of our main goals. I'm going to ask Charlie to come up here too, because through the next few slides we're going to kind of hand it back and forth and talk about some of the projects that we've worked on over the years, but there's a number of major projects, and I'm going to let Charlie talk to you about some of these.
The Lakeview Business Park, most of you know most of the history with that. Some of you are a little bit newer and don't know all of it, but the Lakeview Business Park is really a good example to show you the personality of what we do in economic development. There was a number of very important partners in developing the Lakeview Business Park. Xcel Energy, CenturyTel, and La Crosse County actually partnered in a Lakeview Partners, which was a non-stock corporation and LLC that was created to provide gap financing. LADCO was very important in getting the Lakeview Business Park started, along with the county, the Economic Development Fund, and especially the Village of West Salem. But there was one player in that whole thing, one partner in that whole thing, who was the most important partner, and that was Select Trusses and Lumber. Carl Brickle and his brothers, and Dan Pogreba as the operator of that business, had an opportunity to grow, to expand their business. And all of the work that we did, all of the work that all of these partners did, were for one thing, and it was to give them an opportunity to grow their business. And if you think about the work that went into the expansion of Select Trusses and Lumber, our portion of it was minuscule. Our portion of it was just getting that last project over the hump, putting the straw on that camel's back to break it so that they could expand their business. And that's what we do. That's our job as economic development, is to work with the people that are actually expanding their businesses, creating new businesses, creating jobs, to do a good job of that. So our job is to find their personality, to find where they're going to best fit, what programs are going to best fit their needs, and then get them the help that might get them past the hump. Now, there's risk in all of that, and as you've seen from a lot of the news in the last couple months, sometimes that risk works, sometimes it doesn't. And so that's the whole conversation about economic development, is how much risk do we take. We took a little bit of risk in the Lakeview Business Park, and the reward, I think, at this point has proven itself. The reward has been significant. So you've got phase one, which was Select Trusses and Lumber. We went out and got some grants. We built some public infrastructure. We created a very creative financing process. We worked with the state to get actual legislation where the county was considered a municipality, and which allowed us to be a joint financing, revenue sharing operation with the Village of West Salem, which gets us into phase two. Phase two was really driven by River Steel, and again, they've made the news lately, and you know, the reward there. We got some grants for that. That municipal revenue sharing agreement that was in place allowed us to do a TIF with the Village of West Salem, and then the phase one, I guess that was phase 1A, and phase two then was Amherhart, which expanded their business operations to West Salem, and we put in more infrastructure and got more grants, etc. So the success out at the Lakeview Business Park pretty much speaks for itself. There's now six businesses in there. We haven't seen expansion of that park in the last couple years, obviously because of the economy, but you can still see the results. There's 200 jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of the projects that's very important. County Farm Master Plan, this was a project that the Economic Development Fund really shepherded. And so now we have a plan in place that, you know, it's visible, it's graphic. We've got an idea of how that potentially can develop. And so, you know, when we have potential customers for the project, when we have potential expanded business, they can see the project They can see what the plan is, and then they can invest their money in what they're going to do, whether they're going to expand their business to there, whether they're going to look for residential development, commercial development, multifamily, et cetera. They can see the plan and understand what it is. I think this is about the fourth or fifth model of the plan. And then the Village of West Salem has now adopted a sixth model of the plan. So we've got some plans to show people when they ask what's going to happen out there. This is what we're proposing at this point. Collaboration conference was started by the United Coulee Region. Obviously, my tenure with the county started in 2003. So the first couple of years I wasn't around. In 2003, we really had a wonderful conference at the Cleary Center at the university, which really celebrated a lot of successes in collaboration and got a lot of people together to talk about how we could further that. And some of the things that have come out of the United Coulee Region and the collaboration conference include the Household Hazardous Waste Program and other things that go along with it. And every year since, we've, I think, improved and expanded the menu, if you will, for the collaboration conference. And especially lately, Brian's been taking that on and working hard on it, so I don't know if you have any comments on the conference.
I just wanted to include this because it's a major project that we work on, but it also really represents everything that we stand for. I think at La Crosse County and what we've been trying to accomplish is that so much more can be accomplished through collaboration and working together, and that's really what most of our work is founded in. So we've had some great conferences that have brought together business and community leaders to really start talking about some of the issues that we're facing now and into our future. And really started to look at some innovative strategies for addressing those issues. So, one of the other major things that we do is provide assistance to municipalities. As you go down this list, you'll see that we've touched a lot of different parts of the county in the last 5 years. We worked with the Town of Onalaska and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on a project out there that. Is now actually starting to happen as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has secured some land out there. But at the time, we had secured $545,000 of grant dollars from the DNR. Ultimately, the town chose not to accept that grant, but there was a lot of work that was put into that grant, and this was a great collaboration with the Town of Onalaska, working with their elected officials and staff to work on this project, and it's neat to now see it starting to happen. We provide some staff assistance to the Home and Economic Development Committee, and we've been working with them. One of their most basic needs was they just felt a disconnect with their community, with their business community. So they wanted to start doing a quarterly newsletter. So we've helped them to put that together and create a better connection with their business community in Holman. We're working with the City of Onalaska on their waterfront project. We helped them to sponsor the funding summit. Many of you might have attended that funding summit that happened just a couple months ago. But to really kick off the work that they're trying to do there, and now we're helping their planning staff with the implementation of some of their plans in trying to develop a public market in their downtown area and a number of other things. We've worked with a number of municipalities on TIF districts. Obviously, the villages of Bangor and Rockland don't have the staff that have a lot of expertise in TIFs. So we've been able to, through our work in West Salem with that TIF district, become a pretty good resource for other municipalities in the county on the formation of TIF districts. As you'll continue to hear, the Rockland project is a TIF district that we've become involved in through an unfortunate situation with a residential subdivision that we now own most of through interim foreclosure. But we're working on a collaboration with Coulee Cap as well as the village to form a TIF district there and develop some workforce housing for a growing business in that community. And that's been a really great collaborative project that's helped us to try to get some of our money back out of the special assessments that we've paid into that and back taxes that were owed on that land. But it's really provided a great asset for the village of Rockland as well. And as we go on, the Farmington Agricultural Business Park is an idea that has yet to really happen, but we've talked with them about trying to form an agricultural business park that really fills a niche in our market, but creates some business opportunities in the town of Farmington. So I'll let Charlie talk a little bit about his comprehensive planning work with some of the individual municipalities.
Well, you probably all have a pretty good idea of what we're doing in comprehensive planning, so you've heard plenty of other things tonight. We can kind of go, unless you got questions. We'll working with other departments, we're working with the Solid Waste Department right now on their landfill master plan and working closely with Nick Nichols on sustainability, working with facilities on Park Plaza, solar hot water projects, any type of, right now we're working on drawing some different opportunities for Vine Street, for how that may have landscaping and things like that, and you know, obviously with the zoning department and land information. Conditional use permit survey, one of the things that we see is very important in La Crosse County right now with the current economy is getting small businesses started through the use of conditional use permits. You know, we can't mention economic development without mentioning LADCO and the amount of work that they do in La Crosse County. We work very closely with them on our big projects, but also behind the scenes on a number of other projects where you have a business that looks for help and LADCO calls us and we have this resource, LADCO has that resource, the city of La Crosse has this resource, Onalaska has a different resource. They pull them all together and we pull other stuff together and it really helps our businesses to not have to drive all over town to get that information. We have the Cross Area Promotion Day where we actually go out to different industrial parks and different potential development sites in the entire county. Chamber Business Expo, we all share a booth, and then we've printed the sustainability brochure and the county brochure and other things. We work closely with Cooley Cap and the Cooley Housing Development Corporation. We're one of two land trusts in the state of Wisconsin, which is a creative way to do permanent affordable housing. And we're starting to work very closely with, like Brian said, the Village of Rockland, and we worked closely with the Gund Brewery Lofts on workforce housing issues. And then the Chamber of Commerce, the Aerial Video Project, and Classic Country Roads brochures, and the location of their new facility off of the highway. This is one of my slides. These are numbers from Charlie. So everybody around here knows what that means.
Take it with a grain of salt, in other words.
Well, you double it and then you cut it in half.
I still remember that one.
Excuse me, the finance department did check them.
Okay, we can believe them then.
They check everything I do now. What we've done over the past 7 years, one of the things that we were directed to do from the beginning when I started and when Brian started is go and get grants. And if you look at that left column, these are grants that are awarded. We don't have all of the funding in hand yet, but they are awarded grants. 2004, $759,000. 2005, I don't know, I was sleeping that year. I don't remember what happened. But 2006, $365,000. 2007, $1.4 million. 2008, $50,000. 2009, $40,000. 2010, so far, $1.03 million. And we've got probably another $2 million applications that we should get awarded fairly soon. What you'll see is these grants aren't going to come every year. They're going to come in spurts. But at the same time, we're also building additional capacity with the department. We're building credibility with the departments at the state and the federal government of we do things right. They get their reports. We produce good quality reports, and we show them that we're accomplishing the goals of their grants, and that's why the grant totals continue to increase. And we see this as exponentially increasing. And we expect ourselves to get this to exponentially increase. But if you take the average grant per year, it's about $526,000. Your average staff budget per year of those 7 years was about $83,000. So if you take the total amount of grants, $3.7 million, divided by the average staff cost per year of $83,000, so far we've got 44 years of staff budget and grants. I can retire, right? No? If you take it, take that divided by the total budget average per year, we've got 15.3 years of budget in grants. Now, understand that those, again, are Charlie's numbers. Those grant dollars didn't come directly to our department to offset our department budgets. Those went towards infrastructure in West Salem. They went towards comprehensive planning grants for all of the communities. They went towards building a water tower and a rail spur in West Salem. They went towards other things. So, you know, it's not directly offsetting our budget. You know, that's why these numbers are. But they give you an idea of what value, what return on your investment you're getting for economic development. And this slide is just grants that are awarded. This does not include industrial revenue bonds that we've helped to secure. It does not include other types of bonds that we've helped to secure. It does not include money that we've brought back into the county through revolving loan funds, et cetera, land sales. You know, we're just trying to give you numbers that we can quantify, that we can say these are real numbers, even though I came up with.
It also doesn't include the grants like the one that I mentioned earlier for the town of Onalaska that they ultimately chose not to accept. But, you know, there's certainly some validity to Charlie's numbers, but it doesn't even paint the full picture, I don't believe. We've already talked a lot about the by the numbers of the revolving loan funds, so I won't go through that again. And this is just a by the numbers for our budget. If you look at the last 5 years of total budget and total expenditures, I just wanted to illustrate that we've only spent 85% of what we've been budgeted. So we are frugal with the money that you allow us to use. So it provided a breakdown of that budget: salary and benefits, office expenses, projects, professional development and travel, contributions to partners, and the collaboration conference are the categories that we used to break the budget down. But that just provides you some of those numbers. In summary, as Gary showed you, eventually the county board identified economic development as a priority, and over time we ramped up our role in economic development. We feel that we've made significant progress in the goals that you've set for us. We certainly need to acknowledge the tremendous partners that we have in Greg at the Regional Planning Commission, and his staff, LADCO, the LACVB, the Chamber, the cities, the municipalities, as well as the other staff at the county, all the other departments that I mentioned. We certainly take up a lot of the Corporation Council office time and the finance department time as they help us through these projects. So we certainly have a lot of help in everything that we do. But we feel like we've added significant value to many efforts across the county. And I think what we are trying to illustrate with Charlie's numbers is that there is a great return on this investment. So you've invested some money in us, and we're able to bring money back into the county through grants. We do want to thank you, obviously, our biggest partner. And I'll do a little bit of brown nosing here, but we as I said at the beginning, we really enjoy what we do. We take pride in what we do, and we certainly want to thank you for the opportunity to do what we do. As you can see, we make great cheerleaders for La Crosse County economic development efforts.
Questions, comments? Bill Feehan.
Well, looking at your budget for 2010, which is $308,000, you've made a pretty good case for the work that you do for the $129,000. I'd requested how that remaining money is spent from Gary. And I'd just like to point out to my fellow board members that we're making significant donations to many of these other regional and local economic development organizations. And we're going to have to make some hard choices. And last night I listened to Mike Desmond make a great case for why we should continue to support the Boys and Girls Club and how they work with our social services to help at-risk kids. And so I just like to point out that when it comes time to make decisions about how we're going to spend the money, maybe we need to consider whether we're going to support an organization like the Boys and Girls Club or whether we're going to make a $20,000 donation to a local economic development authority. So Just something to think about.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the good macro scan of economic development activities for La Crosse County. It was very informative. I guess there's one area, though, that, and I don't have any specific questions on this because time is, you know, we spent a lot of time discussing this already tonight. But, Mr. O'Malley, you're going to ask us in a few minutes what are some items for future agendas. I do have one, and that is the La Crosse County Economic Development Fund. I think, it, especially for new members on the board, I think it's critical that there is a special discussion on what this fund is, what is the relationship with the La Crosse County Board and the fund. For example, the fund consists of the 15 members are on the board. 40% are elected officials. 6 out of 15 are elected. 60% are not. What exactly are the for example, what are exactly the statutory controls that this board has in relationship to that fund? I mean, we're hearing all the numbers. We're hearing about the loans. We're hearing about the successes and some of the failures. But what exactly, what is the relationship with this board and that development organization, development fund? And maybe this is good coming from the corporate counsel's office, but I would like some more information on that so we can have a discussion on exactly that fund. And I mean, this is, I've read the I've read this entire sheet. It's very informative, but I guess there's a few more questions I have, and I think it'd be good to, because we, these, once in a while we can take a vote on you know, approving a loan application. I don't think a lot of board members truly understand the new members, and maybe me included, because we don't deal with these issues all the time. But what exactly is that relationship with this body, and what kind of control do we have over that fund? Does that, am I making sense in terms of what I we could discuss in the future?
Okay. We'll do that in the very near future, try to pull that information together.
Yeah, in fact, we could probably do that within one of the next meetings, just have Corp Counsel, Bill Shepard, who drafted the ordinance that established that. He serves on it statutorily. There's a part of state statute why there are certain members on there, including myself, finance director. He has more history in that than Dave would, though Dave could make a good effort. But also that's why we gave you the detail of who's in it, what's actually structured within that. It was a migration, by the way, from the old Economic Development Committee that didn't have the same authority under statute. But that would be easy for Bill to do.
Ralph Geary.
This was created by the county board, so the county board could amend it.
Absolutely.
I mean, we could change the ordinance. We could change the composition of the committee. You could put on two more supervisors, have two less, or... Right. Stick on another banker or whatever, right? So we can bring an amendment to that. So if we can do that, why do we have problems getting information out of that committee?
What information?
When the skipper liner kind of fell down, and then we were informed that we really didn't have any access to that information because that was a separate corporation dealing with this.
We never said this county board didn't have access to information.
You said that we couldn't ask those questions because the economic that committee was dealing with it, and that they were a separate corporation from the county board.
I may have said that we couldn't have some discussions in open session because of what was going on at that time, but this board is...
No, you didn't say that, but anyway, that's good that you clarified it, so... If there is some information we need in closed session, then put it on a future agenda or something if we can't get it in open session.
Oh, absolutely. That body is a subdivision of the county board, and any information you want, you're entitled to get. Now, with regard to Skipper Liner, there's a lot of information right now that even the committee doesn't have because it's in limbo in terms of what's going to happen. I mean, so that's a constantly evolving particular situation there. But if there's information, let us know what it is you want, and we get it to you. Jill Billings.
Are county board members allowed to attend the Economic Development Fund meetings?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And some do who aren't. Sharon Hampson's there all the time, more frequently than some of the committee members. Sharon.
Well, the reason I started going was the Skipper Liner, when that loan came to us several years ago.
And I had no idea at the time that we lent money. So I started going to the meetings. It's very informative. I've learned an awful lot. And the minutes are on the website. So even if you can't go at 7:30 on a Thursday, you can read the minutes.
Other questions or comments? Seeing none, thanks, guys.
We have two additional slides because we wanted to, tying up with economic development, we wanted to just keep you up to date on the status with Park Plaza. Recognize this has been a challenge for La Crosse County for quite a number of years. We obtained it through tax forfeiture. It was an unsuccessful business hotel that went into tax forfeiture. The county got stuck with the back taxes on it and the demolition and asbestos removal. We've got roughly an investment of $750,000 into the back taxes and about $750,000 into demolition and asbestos removal. We've worked closely with the city on this and their redevelopment authority, and unfortunately with the market and the situation it's in, we haven't been able to come up with a development plan that's gotten this solved. The current status, and these last two slides are very brief, but just to bring you up to date, Waterplace One LLC has committed to the lease that came back through you. With the chairman's help, we were able to get an increase in their annual lease to $10,000. That has been paid in full per year. They followed through on every step that they've agreed to. The fuel tanks are removed at their cost and has been accomplished. The deck has been removed, and under the terms of the lease, they will be taking down the Bikini Yacht Club. Make sure that you understand that the part that they're leasing is the part that's just adjacent to the Bikini Yacht Club. They're not responsible for the entire site. We do have an agreement to work together with them on the future development of that site, and we'll be making a number of steps. I've got a second slide, but I see a hand, Mr. Chair.
Actually, a couple of hands. Vicki Burke. Oh, Audrey Kiter.
Thank you. The you clarified for me earlier the fact that the lease is only in relation to the area right beside the Bikini Yacht Club. I am continuing to be concerned that if it's a property that we are truly interested in developing, we need to maintain it in an appearance that looks somewhat ready. It is ready, other than the weeds and the crap that's on it, for development.
Actually, there are a number of things that we have to do. If I can get to the next slide, why don't you hold that question, because I think I can respond to part of it. Brian, if you'd flip to the next slide. The progress that we're making on it, and there will be decisions that you'll have to make as a body as we go through here, is that we're close to resolving the floodplain issues with the site. That's a significant issue that's been ongoing for quite some time on how much fill would have to be involved to actually make it developable. And what we're learning is that we're getting close to resolving that question, again, with Charlie's leadership and the mapping, that we may not have to make the investment we originally thought in the amount of fill that would be necessary to develop that site. Without that resolution, a developer wouldn't be in a position to know what that answer was, and we'll come back to you when we've been able to resolve that. Secondly, working with City Public Works, I'd like to complete the rest of the information so that you see the whole wealth of development of the whole site, Audrey, is that working with City Public Works, there's a number of issues that we need to work with on the design and relocation of the sanitary sewer and the long-term issue with their lift station. There will be decisions that the City Council will have to make on that and their Public Works entity, as well as La Crosse County. But once that's resolved, the location of that and relocation of the sanitary will actually put the developer in a better position to know where they can actually access resources, because right now the current sanitary line actually cuts through that, and that's not an issue that can be unresolved when dealing with the developer. In addition to that, we've identified, with Corporation Council's help and the planning director, our planner, is there's over 20 different easements owned by different entities, some that are still in existence, some that still have an interest, some that don't have a power line. Those 20 easements are barriers to a developer being able to actually move ahead. By identifying all of those and working with each of those entities, from NSP, XL, Peoples Ice and Fuel, Wisconsin Department of Transportation, City, Pettibone Park, there's a whole number of all these 20 different easements that have to be cleared up so that there's a clear ownership not encumbered by easements. Again, that that's another barrier to being able to go ahead. And finally, our goal is to resolve all these issues so that we're in a position to be able to market into next spring. And one of the policy questions that we will come back to you on is how much more investment should we put into that site for beautification and those types of things, that as we're resolving all of these things, what's going to put the best foot forward, so to speak, to be able to market that facility. So yes, you'll need to deal with issues of beautification and site, but all these other barriers that had not yet been resolved. There are a number of things that obviously the City Redevelopment Authority and City Planning had actually spent a lot of time on, with soil borings and a whole set of things that will also make that site better, more easily to be developed. But these are a number of issues that we've identified that would be barriers to proceeding ahead. So those will be issues coming back through the development fund and through the county board on being able to market that site.
And so I want to follow up. I want to follow up on that too, because Audrey, you and I have had that discussion, and I've had the discussion with Jim Spiropoulos, who doesn't know I'm going to call on him, but I'm going to do that anyway, because that is not an issue that we're ignoring. So, Jim, if you can get away from your little computer monitor over there and tell us where we're at and what is our land and what is not our land over there, because some of the eyesore part isn't even our stuff.
We don't have a site plan, do we? No.
You're talking about what the county owns and what Skipper Liner or People's Ice and Fuel owns. And
are we letting our area go to heck?
Well, most of our area is sand, quite honestly. We do own a little bit of blacktop over there, with parking area and a little road around it, but most of it is sand. You don't grow a whole lot in sand other than weeds and a few trees here and there. There's no way we're going to grow grass over there. If we want to go to that level, it's going to require some funding and long-term maintenance. If we grow something over there, we have to maintain it. I'm not totally against that, but going into the 2011 budget with the directives that I've been told to do, that's going to be tough order.
Go ahead, Audrey.
Thank you. Well, it was my understanding that with part of the increase in rent that we were able to get from the portion that now they are supposedly maintaining, that we could at least on occasion mow the weeds. I mean, it just looks, and we're running into this problem all over the place because of shortage of funding. I mean, the approaches to the city are deteriorating in appearance. Now, that's a value statement on the part of some people think it's okay and other people think it's not. But the point of it is that that is a prime piece of land that ultimately we do hope to develop. And to see it in its current condition, people would just drive by it and not even realize that it's a waterfront, that it could be something that they might just want to develop. And I feel that it is something that at least can we not go in and mow the weeds. In fact, the city could cite you for it if we chose to.
Well,
but we
the gauntlet
haven't.
Has been okay. Laid down, Jim.
Just yeah, just
we haven't.
Just to clarify a couple of things, Charlie whispered in my ear that until we have the floodplain issues resolved, I think it would be very pointless to go in and put a lot of topsoil in.
I'm not asking you to do that.
Right.
I'm asking you to just go in.
As regards to the reeds, we can certainly address going in there and mowing that stuff down to make it more presentable. And keeping everyone's eye on the ball, we do not own the waterfront. This is Waterview property. There's 14-foot strip that the county does not own, and that's been one of the hindrances to developing this property. So.
Jim Burns, I saw your hand.
Yeah, thank you. Just a quick clarification. How much land does La Crosse County actually own then?
It's a little over 5 acres, I believe.
Jeff Schrader.
Who is Water Place One?
Jay Heschler and some other people.
So the way it sounds, they're going to control the development there?
They control access to the water. It's our land that's next to there, so it... I mean, if a developer comes in and says, I need water access, we have to go through Jay Heschler to accomplish that. I mean, that's, as Jim said, been the problem the entire time I've been chair. we've been dealing with this issue before I became chair. Jim Mershon was dealing with this issue.
I've been around here.
Yeah, we've had a lot of meetings with Jay, and we get really close, and then it doesn't happen. But he holds a lot of cards there in terms of what can happen, and we're trying to work with that. And, I mean, unfortunately, with the economy right now, we're not having people line up to, you know, to make offers on it, but we're very concerned that it not just lay dormant forever. On the other hand, we're not going to sell it at a sheriff's sale. That would be crazy.
No, but the way the first slide was presented, it sounded like Water Place One was going to have the rights to develop it.
No, that's not at all. Mm-hmm. We leased a part of property. We're getting more out of it, 10 times more in annual lease revenue than we had gotten before. They've agreed to and taken out the fuel tanks, which makes that part of the site, which was partly in our land, partly on their land, available for development. They've committed to tear down the Bikini Yacht Club and get that portion ready. Meanwhile, there's a set of responsibilities that we're working on to get all the infrastructure and property easements and everything lined up so that it is ready. Any developer will have to bid on an RFP basis. No one has an inside track. We will work with whoever is there. There may be developers that will do that without getting water access. But we need to resolve all these other issues to be able to make the site as ready for development as possible, and it will come back through a bid or RFP process through this county board, just as any kind of sale of property would. We've come close several times, but no one has the inside track. Yes, they do control the waterfront. That's one of the difficult issues, but I don't think that's an ongoing barrier. If we can get the rest of these issues done and put it up for market again with the economy changing over the next year, I think we're in a positive position. And regardless, what's our alternative? We own the property. We need to get it ready for sale and do the best we can to eliminate every barrier possible to market this.
Joe Billings.
Oh, just a minute.
Oh, go ahead.
You said Water Place One is leasing it. What are they doing with it?
They're leasing the Bikini Yacht Club, which is part on our property and part on their property. And we've indicated that we don't want to continue this relationship beyond this year, which is why the Bikini Yacht Club will be torn down. The deck was torn down. We want those fuel tanks out, which they've already done. We want to get this in a position that it's ready to market, not to have an ongoing dilapidated structure that needs ongoing maintenance. It's part on our property and part on theirs.
And they're not leasing our whole property.
No.
Just that area where the Bikini Yacht Club is. And the parking, yeah. Now Jill Billings.
Thank you. There's a question in this area of the room about condemnation.
If you want to talk about condemnation, take a look at the billboard issue with the city, and you find out that it's a very, very expensive proposition. This would be astronomically expensive to condemn that waterfront, would be my guess. I mean, that, and Mr. Heschler has made it perfectly clear that he would not part with that property for a song and a dance. I mean, it would make the billboard fight look like small potatoes. That, and we can't do it anyway. It would be the city redevelopment authority that have to do it. So that would be a huge headache for them. I can't see the city getting into that, quite honestly. So. Ralph Geary.
Well, I don't want to get fixated. Everybody gets fixated. Whoever goes over there has got to have water access. What does the phone company have? They got a water view. How about logistics health? Do they have water access? They got a view of the river.
Right.
They built two buildings, now they're going to build a third one. So I'm not fixated on that. The one that I would be worried would be Heschler if somebody like logistics health says, we don't care, we're just going to build an office building there, we're going to have a nice view of the water. How are they going to get to it? They're going to have it's going to be pretty cumbersome for them not to have parking or access to it. So, you know, there's two. I don't care if they got water access or not. If you get a decent business like the phone company or Logistics Health building a building.
Neither the county nor the city's redevelopment authority have ever said that this is a property that needs water access. We have always marketed it as having water view. And if they want water access, they're certainly welcome to talk to Mr. Heschler. But we've never said that that's the only thing that can go in there, something that would have water access. Anybody else? We'll keep you posted on this one. You know, unfortunately, those wheels turn slowly, but we're spending a lot of time on an ongoing basis dealing with it. That gets us to cards and correspondence. Always check the board there to see what's new there. No meetings for the committees during recess. So suggestions for future agenda topics. We already have the stuff from Mr. Burns
Mr. Chair.
That we'll be bringing up. And Steve's got some stuff.
I do have one last item. For those of you back to the earlier presentation, if you want to make a note of it, go to page 11 of your budget book. Page 11, you'll see a line called federal and state revenue of $31 million. Divide that by 113,000, which is your estimated population, and you'll get a figure of total federal and state aid of $279 per capita, which is within $20 of the 2005 number quoted by WTA. Page 11 of your budget book, the line item federal and state revenue, divide that by your total population, you'll get $279, which is within $20 of the 2005 projection for state and federal revenue per capita by WTA. I'll work on the expenditure number, but I figured that out just while we were going through this. Page 11.
Before I call on other people, Ginny pointed out one thing very important that you should know. Do not log out of your computer until we actually take the motion to adjourn or you're marked as absent. So, yes, so Roger, you're absent. Sorry. Okay, I saw some hands. Margaret Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the July report, there was some interesting information about the Transportation Committee and a study that's going to be beginning late summer, early fall of 2010. And it looks to me it's dealing with the north part of the north-south corridor, perhaps. I just think it would be good to have an update on where we are and what's coming down the quote-unquote road.
In addition to that, there was an article recently talking about, I think both the Tribune and the Journal Sentinel, about the whole the high-speed rail issue. So, Steve, let's do an update on both of those things, the whole transportation big-ticket stuff that's going on these days. So we'll put that on as soon as we can get that organized. Anybody else have any suggestions for future agenda items? Ralph, Geary?
Well, put on closed session the stuff you couldn't tell us in open session about Skipper Liner, because I know we had a heavy discussion about it, and I think I don't know if it was Jeff Schrader or somebody was asking questions. You said maybe they couldn't ask him in open session.
Does anybody know what he's talking about?
Yeah,
I'm not sure what I may have said where I said there was some information that we had that we couldn't share. I mean, if there is, I want to do it, but no, I'm not.
No, my recollection of what was said here was the fact that we really don't know, so we can't share anything because we don't know anything.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing discussed.
Well, coincidentally, Skipper Liner was going to be on the agenda for next week anyway, so we'll make it possible potentially for closed session then to bring everybody up to speed. How's that? All right. Any other items for future agendas? I guess that gets us to Jerry Sobranek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point to ponder before we adjourn. We should always try to think before we act, because every act there seems to be a reaction. So just a couple of words of advice. Never slap a man who's chewing tobacco, and Don Beeney can attest to this. Never kick a cow chip on a hot day. And with that, I move the adjournment.
Moved by Jerry Sobranek, seconded by Bob Kyle. All in favor of adjourning, say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.